Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 17th, 2020, and welcome to episode 214 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and computers on TV. But first, I am Paul Hegstrom in Boston, and I am joined by four other retro computing enthusiasts. First on my little clockwise screen is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Hi, everybody. Doing well today.
Excellent.
How about you?
Fine. Very busy for some reason, but... Next up is Jack Nutting in Stockholm. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing well. Calm weekend here, which is always nice.
Very nice.
And which is always the case these days. I feel like I haven't had an exciting weekend since I don't know when.
That's right. It's sometimes a little hard to tell where the boundary between weekday and weekend is.
Right. Yeah, it's all a blur. Yeah.
And from Northern Virginia, Blake Patterson. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm looking forward to a hopefully not too distant haircut. Other than that, I'm doing what it is I can here do at home. So a lot of that is to do with retro. So, good to be here.
Excellent. And lastly, Carrington Vanston from Toronto. How are you?
Not looking forward to a haircut.
That's right.
I'm doing swell. As swell as can be. Maximum swell.
Fantastic.
Super.
All right. So the host topic today is computers in TV and movies. So it came up for a particular reason, which was a link that we didn't talk about last time. So there was a YouTube video called Rebuilding James Bond's Apple IIc, a Software Forgery by Max Piantoni. And Blake had sent this to us as a link, and then we didn't use it.
I'll show you, Blake.
I don't know, Blake, if you wanted to talk through it since you had prepared it, but otherwise I could.
Sure, I could do that. I happened to see this. It's a video where in View to a Kill, which I think was 1984 or 1985, one of the James Bond films, one of my favorites, actually, but it's sort of cheesy in retrospect. Anyway, there's a scene where an Apple IIc is on a coffee table by the bed of the leading lady, and she is a seismologist, and it's tapped into the earthquake center. And so they log in with the 2C, and it runs this program, and it shows some waveform analysis, and then she hits a couple of keys. And then it shows a map of the Bay Area with a pinpointing the location of the small tremor. And so this individual, I don't recall exactly, having been a few weeks, how I stumbled upon it, but this fellow, Max, what's Max's last name?
It is Piantoni.
Piantoni. He made a video and set out to recreate this program. He made an excellent video talking through what it is he did, what he noticed about the original on screen. There's some font considerations, and there are some speed considerations as far as, well, Apple's, you know, he wanted to do this in AppleSoft Basic. It looks like it definitely was done in AppleSoft Basic in the movie. He was trying to figure out how they did it, and he came up with a way to do it using some external tools. Actually, he utilized Beagle Brothers or Beagle Bros Apple Mechanic shape table system to make the animations work. And it's pretty fascinating to watch. So he shows it running on his system. It's basically an exact clone. And he also put it on GitHub and released the source code, released the AppleSoft Basic source code so you could run it And I actually ran it on my 2E, and it runs quite nicely. It's interesting to see. But yeah, it's very impressive. And he actually sent me an update over Twitter. He has enhanced the program beyond the movie version, such that if you strike a key in the second screen, it'll actually take you back to the first. So it's more powerful than the movie original at this point. He updated it within the past week, and that's presumably on GitHub. I haven't tried that version out, but yeah, it's very impressive. And it definitely was a scene that I remembered very well, which is why I reacted to it and put the little blog post together. That was my favorite part of the movie. But anyway, so it runs just great. On you can just download it, put it on a disc, and boot it up. It's a lot of fun. I think I left it running for the entirety of several work days here during the shutdown to my left, and that made working at home a little more special. So, and that's how our topic came to be.
Yeah, so I think, it's a pretty broad topic, and I think we're all sort of talking about different things. But one possible angle on this is just like the View to a Kill, where there were sort of contemporary computers, you know, from our past, but contemporary to the movie, that were being used. And those are, you know, it's kind of fun to see those because, of course, they were rare and new and mysterious at the time. But there's also been a fair number of modern shows that have either been set in the past or just have incidental old computers around. So we can sort of just go around. There's so much to talk about here. I don't know. I have no idea where this is going to go. Just seemed like it would be interesting to talk about. So maybe, Earl, we can start with you. What thoughts did you have?
Sure. Well, I'll be quick. One of these is an old computer, and it's supposed to be old in context. This was in the movie Terminator. I think it was Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines. There's a scene in the movie where they wind up in a room with a bunch of old computers and technology. And as you pan across this, this basically full room of old computers, I think they were like reel-to-reel tape drives and all that, you see a Commodore PET. And that's the one, of course, that, you know, struck me when I was looking at it. I was like, hey, check it out, a Commodore. So that was fun. But it's supposed to be old in that particular setting. So, on the other hand, there was another where it's kind of funny because it's old. There's this spoof parody movie called Star Wreck in the Perkinning. Have any of you guys ever seen that movie? If you have any Star Trek in you at all, you should go see that movie. I think you can find it on YouTube because it's stinking hilarious. You'll need captions because it's Finnish. Sure. And by that, I don't mean it's done. I mean, it's from Finland.
I've never heard of it.
The poster for it is amazing.
Yeah. And in one scene in this movie, there's a couple of Commodore 64s that are running a nuclear power plant, which I just, remembering the QA on Commodores, I would not want them anywhere near a nuclear power plant. But, and this is a Commodore guy talking. So anyway, those were my two that came to the top of my head when I thought about this topic. But then, as I thought about it a little further, there's a couple I didn't put in the show notes. There was an old show called UFO. Do you guys remember that one? It only ran for one season.
I think I might.
And anyway, it was sci-fi. Has kind of, even to this day, kind of a cult following. But
How old are we talking? Like, what decade?
I think it was 70s because...
Well, yeah, I don't know it.
In the movie, or, I'm sorry, not the movie, in the show, 1980 is still in the future. And they portray 1980 as, wow, this is going to be so amazing in 1980.
They were right.
We'll have, you know, electric cars with doors that fling up like a DeLorean and all this kind of, and that stuff didn't happen, but that's okay. I don't have my hoverboard either. But a lot of the technology that they showed that was supposedly this way cool, amazing, futuristic stuff in 1980 would actually be starting to be kind of passé by the time we got to 1980, like reel-to-reel tape storage, teletypes, all kinds of teletypes in this show. And I also remembered a teletype as being one of the primary interfaces for this movie called Colossus, the Forbin Project. We've talked about it before on the show, where this big computer in charge of the nuclear weapons takes over the world, yada, yada. But
don't yada Colossus Forum Project. It's amazing.
It is. It really is. And actually, I found out by doing some research on this for the show that they've come out with it in Blu-ray. And they had a couple minutes of the sample footage on YouTube. It's gorgeous. So if you are a fan of that movie, which I am, I think you should look into the Blu-ray.
That is awesome. I didn't know it was on Blu-ray, and I will absolutely snag it.
I wonder if we should swap out the host's gift idea. We'll see.
So those are mine. I don't mean the Blu-ray, although I am going to buy the Blu-ray.
That's a 10%. 100%. Colossus is amazing. Have any of you guys read the book series? Colossus is like the first book of three.
No.
I read the first of the trilogy.
Yeah.
I haven't read the rest.
I'm in the same position. I've got all three in like used old chewed up paperbacks, which is really a great way to read those books. Third one is called Colossus and the Crab. So I have no idea how this story gets to that place, but I'm interested in finding out.
I mean, even the movie, I don't want to spoil it, but it ends in a sort of a cliffhanger. I will say that. So it would be interesting to know how the story progressed from there.
The funny thing is the movie is sexist, of course, because of it really just when it was 1970 film shock, it's sexist. Mm-hmm. The book is so much more, like so much more. So that's the thing to brace yourself for if you read the book. But I still recommend it. Like it's a fun book. And a great
temporal
movie.
Culture shock.
Oh, big time. Big time. Yeah. But a great movie. I love it.
Warning taken.
Yep.
It is kind of funny, this, you know, the idea of sort of like panning over old tech, including a Commodore PET or whatever, in an old movie. This movie is an old movie, right? Terminator Rise of the Machines. I don't think I've seen it.
Well, it's old, but it's not supposed to be old enough where people would still be using a Commodore PET or reel-to-reel tape decks or that kind of thing. So they are supposed to be retro old technology and context. I don't want to talk any more about that because I would give away one of the interesting things about the film.
Oh.
And I don't want spoilers.
Okay. Fair enough. But I guess I was just thinking that, you know, as we get further and further away from when that was made, you know, it starts looking like just really very fine degrees of old, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like old tech looking at what seems like the day before and mocking it.
Right. Mm. Old by a few years, whereas now we're looking at it old by a few decades.
Yeah.
Right.
Like you have a mighty list here.
Oh, yeah.
It's a mighty list.
I'd quickly move through. I mean, there's some that you, it's hard. I mean, you almost don't need to mention, like, obviously War Games. You know, everyone knows about War Games. And
never heard of it.
What was that? You haven't heard of it yet?
Never heard. Yeah, would you recommend it?
With the famous MSI 8080. And yeah, that was the movie that really kind of got me started. But some of the more obscure, there's one I'm sure everyone saw this. It's The Fantastic World of DC Collins from 1983. It was a TV movie starring Gary Coleman as a a daydreaming sort of spy detective hero type thing. It's very bizarre. But I remember at the time it came as one of these, you know, we didn't have a lot of television movies back in the early 80s, and so you watched what came on. And at the time I had a TI-99/4A, and DC Collins also had a TI-99/4A. And it was another movie where a spy had embedded, you know, there was a great deal of blueprints that were recorded onto an Atari cartridge, an Atari 2600 cartridge. I've seen several movies where the Atari cartridge is used as a storage device for, you know, like, world domination plans. I guess it was the capacity, you know, that sort of thing. But anyway, so that was there. And that means, of course, there was an Atari 2600 in it as well. But and most everyone here remembers WizKids, the TV series, I'm guessing. Yeah. And where the main guy, Ralph, he was the big computer fellow, and they would fight crime, and they had a police officer friend. I don't know what kind of computer it was. I look back. I can't determine. I think it was more like he had terminals, and I bet there was an S-100 bus machine on a shelf somewhere, but he didn't have any, I couldn't find any brand named items. It certainly wasn't anything like a Commodore 64.
Yeah, he had that room full of stuff. I've seen it all. Yeah.
He had a room full of stuff. He had like a robot arm, and something would project a laser on the wall. I mean, it was a little gratuitous, I think. But at any rate, you see that that speaks more. He probably had an S100 box filled. Every card, you know, had some other crazy thing in there. I think it would even make him coffee or eggs or something. I don't know. He named his computer Ralph. But
There was a show that at Kansas Fest, like the first episode was read out. I think it was last year.
WizKids.
Was it
WizKids? Oh, it must have been. Okay. Wow. Yeah. Okay. I now remember.
And the series is available, but not. It's like rips from old VHS copies or whatever. It's hard to watch, but it's still worth watching.
Yeah. Okay. And I forgot to put it in the show notes, and I don't know if anyone has bought it. It's worth putting it in there, but I found the entirety of The Fantastic World of DC Collins on YouTube, but I can't really recommend.
Oh, fantastic.
I don't know if I recommend sitting down and watching it. At any rate, just to get through a few more, a big movie for 84 was 2010, and that's I've seen in comments and in references on Twitter and other media regarding Max's View to a Kill piece, like half the people that responded mentioned this scene at the end of 2010, the year we made contact, where
it's a very portable 2C.
Yeah, Roy Scheider's on a beach with an Apple 2C with that LCD that Apple put out that I'm sure like seven people purchased. There's no cord going in the back of the Apple, but he's typing on it about, you know, a letter to his son in the future, and there's, you know, two suns in the sky. So that was that really got me as well. Again, I had a 2C at that time, so I got really excited about that.
If you had one of those flat panel displays, you might well not know the difference between having it on and not having it on.
I was thinking the same thing, especially out in the sun like that.
They are really bad.
It occurred to me that the reason that he was using it in full sun on the beach was that he wanted to be able to read it because, you know, of course, there's no backlight. I think you could only read it in direct sunlight.
Oh, I guess, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, it is impossible to see, though. It is so bad.
Yeah.
It looks neat, but like, it's unusable.
I think in the extended cut after that, he speaks maledictions under his breath about having to drag that darn thing out to the beach again just to write a letter. So, yeah, but
because in the future there are no pencils.
That's right. What were you going to say, Jack?
Oh, just I remember seeing the movie, but it was a long time ago. So, so you're saying there's a scene at the end where he's in the year 2010. He's sitting on the beach with an Apple 2C
because it looks so futuristic. It's just him in his shorts. Okay.
That's right.
On the sand.
That's right.
Okay.
It is set in the year 2010, and he has the Apple 2C.
Makes total sense.
And I mean, it seemed fine to me. I couldn't see giving up my 2C before 2010.
Well, the full name of the movie is 2010, the year we make contact at 300 baud.
So That's right. So just to move through a few more, one of my favorite movies, it's very cheesy and it doesn't really hold up, I guess, but has anyone else seen Electric Dreams?
Yep, love triangle between a man, a woman, and a computer.
Exactly.
I remember that.
It's a really good movie with a really good soundtrack. ELO. Yep. I think Boy George and some other. It was a pretty good soundtrack. He buys a pine cone computer, brings it home, dials up into his office mainframe. Apparently there's too much data. Well, he specifies that it's an amount of data to receive, and he typed the word unlimited, and that's where the mistake happened, because it overloaded the computer. It started to smoke physically, and so he used champagne to put out the smoke. And
like you do.
And that's when the fun begins. I don't want to spoil too much. Like you do. Yeah.
I usually like to, reefer capacitors. Champagne's the best bet.
70s, 80s, there's a lot of movies where some form of electricity and water spike or whatever gets the whole Frankenstein thing, and the computer's alive. The computer in that case, well, Virginia Madsen's the lady, but the computer's voiced by Bud Cort.
Yes.
The guy from Harold and Maude. Brewster McCloud and stuff. And so many things.
And Bernice bobs her hair, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah. Bud Cort. It's worth watching, I think. I say
totally worth watching.
But it's worth watching. And it was interesting. I think there actually was a clone, like an Apple clone computer maker called Pinecone or something, but they used that name. I think I saw an ad for a Pinecone, but it wasn't this computer at all. It was just they created a brand because it was Apple, you know, pear, apricot, all that. Anyway, I'll just move through quickly. Another movie that I was quite fond of back at the time was Cloak and Dagger, which was
another cartridge. Cartridge saves the world kind of thing.
Yes, the cartridge was, there's a chip that, this chip doesn't belong here, and it's got a wire that goes and attaches it. It's actually William Forsythe. It's his first role, I think, and he's running a video game shop, and in the back, room, there's an Atari 800, and he's working on that, and he's got a he analyzes this cartridge, and it's interesting that they refer to the through every scene of the movie, they refer to this cartridge as a tape. It's an Atari tape. They said, "Here, you've got the game tape. Give me that tape." And he said, "I'm going to open this tape up, and I see a chip is out of place." It was always a tape, so. Yep. You know, I don't know if it's interesting to contemplate where that came from.
It's where fellow podcaster Jack Flack gets his name from.
Yes, Jack Flack with Dabney Coleman. I think also a good movie. I think worth watching if you haven't seen
it. Yep. Yeah, definitely.
See, Carrington's with me.
Oh, I'm totally with you.
I remember at the time I was disappointed that the game itself, because they're playing the game.
Yeah.
There's a game, Cloak and Dagger, in the movie,
yeah.
which was also an arcade game, but it never actually came out for the Atari 8-bits as a released game.
Oh, I didn't know
that. There's a prototype.
Oh.
I saw somebody playing a prototype of it on YouTube. It was going to be released, but never was. It was never finished.
That sounds kind of like the Last Starfighter story, but that's another story.
Right.
Yeah, so I got a few more. I'll move down quickly. Weird Science. Everybody knows about Weird Science. They use a computer to create a woman. And as one does, it's a Memotech MTX-512, which is a very sexy looking black computer. I remember recognizing it at the time. I don't think the movie oversells its capabilities, I'll say. I think they probably sold a few. That's the only batch of sales they probably had, but it was an oddly expensive computer with weird MIDI capabilities. And so a few others, Knight Rider TV series. I remember, you know, Knight Rider Kit, the car, that's a computer. But, at the time I had a TI-99/4A, and I remember I heard about the TI Professional, and I somehow, that's a PC clone, but I got it in my head that it was a Super TI-99, and so I wanted one, and then I wrote away for the booklet, but it was thousands of dollars. Still, I was all into TI, and, in the back of their truck, where they would drive Kit up into the back of the truck, there was a TI professional that they would help analyze things. But, you know, you can't actually drive up into the back of the truck. What they would do is they would lower the car out and let it release, and then they would reverse the film. Because if you accelerate a car up a ramp, it'll fly into the back of the truck. Did you guys know that?
Yeah, I've always figured, like, if you hit that ramp, you'd be going so fast, boom.
They reversed it. They reversed the film. So a little interesting tidbit about that.
Interesting.
And then I'll just sweep through the last few. Kindergarten Cop. It is not the Tuma, Arnold Schwarzenegger, 1990. There's an Apple II GS in the classroom by the window. City Slickers with Billy Crystal in his office where he sells on-air advertising space. There is an Amiga 3000, which was, I think, the go-to machine of most advertising salesmen at the time. Not
Certainly.
Actually. But and then the last one is Wayne's World. I remember seeing the Amiga 2000 with a video toaster, and I think Garth has a video toaster t-shirt in Wayne's World 2. Yeah, it was a scene.
Didn't know that.
It was a scene, one of the first scenes that we saw out of, I can't think of his name now, but it's not important. But anyway, so that's my list, and there you go.
That's awesome. Okay, let's see. Carrington, you have another list.
Me. Okay. Yes. So thinking about this, I was trying to pick like one representative thing per decade, because there's a million things you could pick. My mind went to movies rather than TV. Mm-hmm. Though there's now all I can do is think about the IT Crowd. I want to go back and watch everything immediately again. It's that good. But starting with the 1950s, my first choice was Desk Set, which is an old Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn movie about a computer. So he plays a methods engineer, whatever the heck that is, and he's bringing a big old computer, like the size of a house, into automate a thing. And Katharine Hepburn, it's your typical Battle of the Sexes movie that they did over and over again. So it's the EMRAC, which I think was Electromagnetic Memory and Research Arithmetical Calculator, probably something like that. Anyway, so it's an ENIAC ripoff. She plays somebody named Bunny, which we'll come back to later in the episode. So it's a call forward to. I will be talking about it. Somebody else named Bunny in our show notes. And it's a sort of a predecessor to Electric Dreams, in that you got a guy who's kind of in love with a computer in this case, though, and then falls for Bunny, and Bunny's not sure if he loves him more than the computer, so she's going to set it to self-destruct and see if he'll turn it off or let it destroy. It's, you know, 1950s. For the 60s, I'm picking Alphaville, which is a really good black and white film noir. It's a technocratic future. So a computer called the Alpha 60 runs everything and it's banned all emotions. So it's exactly the movie you would expect from that. The original title was Tarzan versus IBM. So it's great. Highly recommended. Have any of you guys seen Alphaville? It's a weird little cult film.
No, I haven't heard of that. I saw Desk Set at some point in the past.
Okay, yeah. But, that said, it's a little easier to come by. Yeah. Alphaville is a French film. I think the full title was The Strange Adventure of Lemmy Caution. That's the guy's name in it. But it's not. I'm making it sound like a comedy. It's not. It takes itself very seriously. But it's good. It's like a good film noir, black and white, you know, hardcore film about computers and technology in the 1960s. So that's neat. For the 1970s, I figured somebody's going to talk about Colossus. That would have been my choice. But instead, I'm going to go with World on a Wire, which might be a little obscure if you don't know your German stuff. So it was a German two-part miniseries from 1973. And it was kind of remade as The 13th Floor. So in 1999, when all the films got rushed out. 1999 was a great year for film. Anyway, it's a two-part miniseries. This worth watching. It's, you know, 3.5 hours or something total. And it's about a company that runs a computer that can simulate a reality. So 9,000 people are living inside this computer. And it's about the company that runs the computer. And the people inside the computer don't know they're in a simulation, except one of them needs to, because it's the person you can communicate with to control it. And then somebody in the building that runs the computer starts thinking there's a lot of stuff in common here, and starts to think that they're also in a simulation and tries to figure out how to talk to one simulation up from the world they live in. And it's neat. So kind of a slow burn, but good. And much better than the 13th Floor, I think. So that's my choice for 1970s. 1980s, there's like a million things because it's the best decade that ever was. I think, what did I put in the show notes here? I think I picked Crosstalk probably.
Yep.
What did I pick? Crosstalk. Okay, Crosstalk is good. It's an Australian film. This one is hard to discuss. I would recommend it. It's spoilery, but it's about a computer that's like murderous. There's a lot of murderous computers in the 1980s. But this one has a reason to be murderous and is trying to communicate in a sense through his murder, but also trying to communicate to a one person. So it's kind of a mix of Rear Window with murderous computers in the 1980s in a neat early 80s Australian film. And the CompuColor 2 is the featured computer, the murderous CompuColor 2. So if you ever want to see, like, how could a CompuColor 2 start bumping people off? And it can adjust blood pressure and things like that. It's neat. So I don't know if I mentioned it specifically, but there's so many great ones in the 80s. There's Evil Speak with Clint Howard, you know, Ron Howard's brother, B-movie staple, and he summons Satan through his computer and he's cutting people's heads off. Like, if you like horror movies from the 80s, it's a great one. And Takeover is about a guy named George. It's another one of those computers that's simulating things. So George runs a software firm that makes simulations. And so George is running a piece of software called the George One, which is a simulation of himself. And when George's life becomes really crappy, his home life, George One says, you know, the only solution is to kill yourself. And the computer is trying to convince him to commit suicide. So that's Takeover from 1987. That's a good one. Or the Rachel Papers, if you have a soft spot. That's about a guy who uses an Amiga 500 to try to win a lady and play a lot of battle chess. So if you're an Amiga fan, Rachel Papers could be good. For the 90s, I honestly thought I was going to have to pick something like The Net or something cheesy, because all the 90s movies are terrible. And I figured or Johnny Mnemonic. I like that guy. But nobody talked about Triumph of the Nerds or Pirates of Silicon Valley. Two obvious choices. So not really about specific computers, but about computers and kind of looking back. So Triumph of the Nerds, basically about the development of the computer from the 1940s through to the then present, like mid-1990s, or Pirates of Silicon Valley, which weirdly has Anthony Michael Hall well cast as Bill Gates. And you wouldn't think Anthony Michael Hall and well cast would ever be like put together in a sentence, but whatever. It's weird. I can't remember who plays Steve Jobs.
It's Noah Wiley. And I think it's, of all the Jobs movies, I think by far Pirates of Silicon Valley is the best that gives the history of Apple. And I mean, it also includes, you know, several other things that are happening, Microsoft. But I think even if you just look at the Apple side of it, because there's so many Jobs movies, I find it by far the best.
I agree. Did you know that about the time Noah Wiley appeared at Macworld?
Keynote. Yeah, he started the keynote.
It's because Steve Jobs had contacted him and told him, I hate the movie. And I think it's terrible and it's very poorly made, but I like your portrayal of me because you kind of look like me. Like, that is the compliment. That's all he was able to come. It's, oh, and by the way, do you want to come and be a Macworld? I'm like, oh, Steve Jobs, you were such a monster. Wow. Hackers is the 1990s. Nobody wants to talk about that, but I remember all the duos in it. My gosh. Mm-hmm. For the 2000, I would pick Computer Chess, which is not from the 80s, but it's set in the 1980s, so it's still kind of retro. Black and white film. It's a black and white indie film from 2013, so you can just imagine how seriously it takes itself. But it's still a good film. Like, it's a good little indie film. I would recommend it. And for the 2010s, I don't know what we call that decade now, I'd say the John Wick series, because it's great action series. People use VIC-20s in it, and I don't even know why, but like the hotel that manages everything, it's a bunch of VIC-20s, and I have no idea why, but they look really cool, so go watch John Wick kick everybody's butt because they hurt his dog, and you can see VIC-20s in the films. So those were my choices.
So in John Wick, the computers are, in fact, actually, they're not supposed to be old. They're supposed to be just in use.
Yeah, I think they're using them because like you couldn't hack them or something. Like, I don't understand. Like, everyone's just using VIC-20s. And I think some other retro computers too, but they keep zooming in on VIC-20s.
See, you mentioned Triumph of the Nerds and Pirates of Silicon Valley as you know, like, I didn't know. I'd never seen Triumph of the Nerds. I do agree with Pirates of Silicon Valley. Yeah. That's an excellent movie.
It's the good one of the two, I think.
But of course, when I read Triumph of the Nerds, I just assumed it was like Revenge of the Nerds 2.
Oh,
no. So this is actually like a historical
Wasn't movie? Triumph of the Nerds, wasn't that a documentary?
Yeah, it's a documentary.
That's much better.
Yeah, it's a documentary about the computer development for like the 50 years up to it. So it's worth watching. Yeah, Revenge of the Nerds movies, if you have any memory of them being good or not insanely offensive, just don't go back.
Yeah.
Don't rewatch them. You cannot watch those things with modern sensibility and not
some
like
movies don't age well.
Never again.
never. Like, I watched the original Revenge of the Nerds just a few years ago, and I was like, I have to take a shower. I can't believe as a kid I thought this was some sort of comedy instead of like the most offensive thing on film. It's shocking. Right. The nerds are not the good guys, man. The nerds are not the good guys in that film. No. I had no idea. Oh.
I read an article a few years ago that highlighted some of the lowlights, and I was like, oh my God, I forgot. Yeah, yeah, that and that and that.
Yeah,
oh,
it's amazing because they're supposed to be the heroes and the jocks are the bad guys. I'm like, no, the jocks are kind of crappy and the nerds are monsters.
Yes.
Who knew? Yeah.
Yeah. Very weird. Jack, were there any things that you wanted to put in?
What have we left?
I didn't make a list or anything like that. You guys covered a lot of stuff, which is good. But to me, the thing that has been sort of a keynote of computers in movies and TV throughout my life is that I've almost always thought it always sucks.
Yeah.
Like, the people who make TV and make movies don't understand how computers work.
I don't think they care.
Like, 97% of the time, just like, oh, let's make a scene with a computer in it and some crazy stuff happens. And it's always so wrong. And I want to point out the one current exception that is pleasing me a lot. It's a small bit of it. There's a series called Manhunt Unabomber, currently on Netflix. It's a new series. And it's set in 1995 and 1997 in the pursuit of the Unabomber and then the aftermath when he's in jail and is about to go on trial. And in that, like, it's not – the computers aren't a central thing. But when they do show a computer, it is very clearly – it's a computer that – looks like it's from the 90s. And in one scene, it's like, yep, that's Windows 95. Another one, it was like, yep, that's either Windows 3.1 or maybe OS 2. And very much like not doing anything crazy, not doing anything like totally out of character for what you would do with a computer at that time. Dial-up modems, all this kind of thing. So
nice. They must have a good technical consultant.
Yeah, they must have. So that was nice. Nice for a change. But I remember, especially when I was a teenager, when I was a kid, I would get excited about movies that were science fiction or had some premise involving computers. And then when I would see it, I would always be like, oh, man, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I do remember that some things that even though they were ridiculous, like Electric Dreams, I really liked that movie when it came out.
I think maybe The Net was the first movie that I saw, if I'm remembering right, where they decided we needed an IP address version of the 555 for phone numbers in all of the movies. Mm-hmm. They had IP addresses with things like 300s and 400s in them and stuff like that. I was like, wow, did we add some extra bits to IP. But, you know, obviously they did that so that somebody wouldn't start pinging the IP addresses that they were showing in the movie, just like they use the 555 numbers for the phone numbers in the movie so people don't start crank calling them. But just bugs me. Like, I was like, I don't like it. That's my rant for the day.
No, it is. It is pretty frustrating. I remember having those same thoughts. Actually, one of the things that makes me think about is Mr. Robot seems like I haven't actually watched that all the way to the end, but often they ride fairly close to the line of plausible. You know, what they're typing is stuff that you could type at a Linux command prompt, and you know, maybe exactly what they're doing. And I forget exactly even how the plot works anymore. It's been so long since I've watched it, but I do remember thinking, oh, okay, well, you know. They didn't call attention to it, but they did type the right stuff at the command line. So,
well, and, you know, again, with your audience probably isn't going to know what you're doing, right? Or if you're getting it right or wrong.
Hmm.
Like, I'm thinking back to the original Terminator when he was listing off his subroutines. Weren't they in 6502? I remember something like the... So, you know, I guess they want to be cost effective with their Terminators.
That's right.
Yeah,
it was.
For any of those 32-bit chips.
I think it's the case that everything is always wrong in all movies because they just want to make a good story and they'll sacrifice everything else. So the thing that you know about, if you know about computers, all the computers seem wrong. I bet if you know about gardening, all the gardening stuff in every movie is terrible. I think just everything is wrong in every movie.
That's probably
and even if they make movies about making movies, I love movies about making movies. Those are often all wrong. They're like, it doesn't matter if it's reality. Who cares? It's a movie.
Right.
I think it's just everything's wrong all the time. I should mention, I can't believe I didn't think of this. I want to change one of my choices. 1990, it should be the KGB, the computer and me, which is the Cliff Stoll thing for the Cuckoo's Egg.
Yeah.
I love Cliff Stoll and his Klein Bottle stuff. And like, that's a good nerd guy.
There's a movie?
There's a movie. Yeah, it was like a direct-to-TV movie. Uh-huh. I think it was direct-to-TV from 1990, and it stars Cliff Stoll. It's basically just him playing himself about what he did 4 years earlier, about being an astronomer nerd and finding that small 50 cents or 75 cent discrepancy and then tracking down a KGB mole or whatever. And it's a great little hacking movie, and I would recommend it. I like Cliff Stoll a lot. So
I love that book.
Yeah, I love the book too. So you should see the movie. The movie is, hypothetically, if you went to YouTube and typed in the Cuckoo's Egg, you'd probably find the entire film.
I might find it.
Yeah. Just saying.
Yeah.
Hypothetically.
Yeah. I was thinking that also in the context when I was thinking about Mr. Robot, that I think also is relatively accurate as to what he was doing. The book is super detailed about exactly how he was following the path.
I recommend the book. It's a great read. I really like it.
And Earl, you said you had lunch with him at some point, right? With Cliff Stoll?
I did.
Oh, it was you.
No, yeah, it wasn't me.
Okay.
No.
Would have loved to, but you did Carrington?
Yeah, as a birthday gift.
Oh, awesome.
Not from him. He didn't say, I gave you lunch with me.
That's right. Very cool.
Yeah, I know somebody who knows him, and so, yeah, I got lucky. It was awesome. He's great. He is what you would think he would be. He is in person exactly. He's Cliff Stoll all the time, 24/7, and it's great. We talked about Klein bottles. He's really, really excited about Klein bottles. Really sustainably excited about Klein bottles.
Well, okay, so I had a couple of things. So my focus had been basically on modern shows in which old computers feature. I feel like, I don't know if this is newly true, but it sort of seems like it's newly true that like everybody who makes TV is now our age or something like that and looks fondly back on the 80s. And so suddenly there's a big, you know, rush of things that were set in the 80s. So Halt and Catch Fire is sort of an obvious one. I'm sure we've talked about that several times.
Now, I've seen the first series of Halt, or the first season of Halt and Catch Fire. Is it worth continuing on?
Well, it's been a little while since it stopped. I think my memory was that it kind of dipped a little bit, but then got better.
I think you're right.
Okay. Because I didn't like the end of the first series. I was like, okay, I'm not going on.
So I'm about to start watching it on Netflix.
Well, then you'll let us know.
One of the things that I did before I jumped in was to check out the reviews, things like Rotten Tomatoes and other sites like that.
Mm-hmm.
It got great reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the series as a whole. So I figured it's definitely going to be worth my time.
Yeah. it's sort of somewhere on the boundary between realistic and not. I mean, there's some stuff where you just think that's like the least smart way you could do this thing that you're trying to do.
And you know, like a chain of LEDs when you're trying to reverse engineer the BIOS. Yeah.
For example.
I always use LEDs for that.
Always.
But yeah, I mean, like it's still, yeah, I mean, it's fun to see all the computers around in each season is basically them inventing a new industry, basically. You know, I think the first season was them sort of starting up essentially Compaq. And then I forget exactly which seasons were which, but they also started up something which is essentially like, and now I'm forgetting the name of it again, but the Commodore virtual place that turned into AOL later, Quantum Link.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Quantum Link. And then there was like a sub-game within that. I think it was called Habitat.
Yeah.
That everybody loved.
So I think that one season was basically them doing that. But yeah, no, I think that was interesting. But it was set at a time when all these computers were around. And I think that's actually one thing that's kind of neat about these new things, is that we have like HD video of old computers professionally shot.
Yes.
Oh, that's a good point.
Sometimes it can even feel... like if you're watching, well, Stranger Things was another one that does that, and the Goldbergs too. And I think both of those sort of capture the 80s relatively well.
Yep, Stranger Things definitely. Stranger I haven't seen the Goldbergs.
So good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So good.
I agree with you. I think Halt and Catch Fire, I really like the first. And, you know, the end of it sort of, you wanted to see what the second season was going to be about. And maybe there was a dip. I like it. But then I kind of stepped away from it because other things came up. Did it end after three seasons, Halt and Catch Fire? Or is it?
I think it was four.
Okay. But it's over.
It is over, yeah.
Okay. I do want to watch it, but I haven't. Yeah. There's other things. Yeah, I need to.
I thought it was four also.
Okay, yeah. I don't know.
There's so many things to watch.
Yeah, that's... There really
That's
are.
True.
Plus, I'm about to rewatch all of the IT Crowd, apparently. So.
Yeah, right. But yeah, so, and there is The Americans, too, that was set in the 80s. These, the spy couple, deep cover spy couple. And I think, I'm trying to remember, I think what used to be called the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Society, or whatever they are, March.
March.
Now part of VC Fed, participated in giving them some of the machines. I think that's correct.
Oh, cool.
But... And actually, Young Sheldon too, which is the sort of like 80s spinoff of The Big Bang Theory, which is like Sheldon as a kid. You know, he's got a computer on his desk, and occasionally there are computers that show up and stuff like that. And that show, actually, I don't mind that show. The Big Bang Theory, I kind of don't like.
I liked The Big Bang Theory when it first started,
yeah,
and then it lost me hard.
Yeah. So.
I went from being a fan to being an unfan.
Yeah.
I don't know what the word for unfan is.
Yeah, I kept the same. I was a fan for several years. And then eventually just like, you know what? I've had enough of them mocking Sheldon for everything all the time. It's like, yeah. Just at some point, it's just like, this is just like, they're not even his friends. They're just being abusive. And it's just
it did kind of become one of those things like most sitcoms where the friends are not actually friends. You sit back and go, but you guys are really dysfunctional.
Right.
Yeah. And I think with the thing about The Big Bang Theory too is that even up when you step away from the internal dynamics of the people, what the audience is supposed to find funny is like it's sort of just like it's kind of mean in a way. It's kind of like look at this dumb way all these people operate, unlike us normal humans.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let's laugh at the nerds. Then one day I realized, oh wait, I'm the nerds.
Yeah. But Young Sheldon seems less like that.
The existence of Dungeons & Dragons isn't inherently funny.
Right.
Halt and Catch Fire is four seasons, by the way.
Okay.
Wait.
Thanks.
Okay. I can count.
So the Goldbergs had a spinoff called Schooled, which is set in the 1990s.
I did not know that.
It's not bad. Some of the characters carried over. But now there's like a Mac, a Mac Plus in the dorm room and that kind of thing. One thing that I think I've mentioned a fair bit before, as things came up, is Blindspot. I'm not sure that I like the show that much, but I really kind of like their dedication to bringing in retro stuff. So there was a time when one sort of lead character tech person, she was talking about how she loved Oregon Trail, and somebody got her, a floppy disk of Oregon Trail as a gift. And then there was another point where they had to like solve some puzzle that involved like Logo, where they were like driving a turtle around. Oh,
excellent. That's awesome.
There's a bunch of stuff sort of, you know, stuck in there. And Jack, you had at some point you had mentioned Preacher had like right. a Commodore in it at some point. I put that in my list just because I remember you mentioned it, but
yeah, that's right. At some point, I think it was maybe I don't remember if it was the first or second season, but there was a bad guy character who was somebody who like he ran like a meat processing plant or something, and like on his and so he's just kind of like a terrible evil executive, but like not of a huge world dominating corporation, but just like local bad guy. And his on his desk was it was either a VIC-20 or a Commodore 64. I don't remember.
Cool.
But it's supposed to be set in, you know, modern times. It's not set at the 80s or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of funny.
I shifted without mentioning it, but I shifted into shows that are set now, but with old computers in them. So Blind Spot's like that. You know, that's a total current show. In fact, in the show, in the fiction of the show, in the world of the show, that person who got the Oregon Trail disc, her father is Bill Nye, the science guy.
Oh, no.
So he shows up occasionally in the show. And but yeah, I mean, so that's modern, but looking back at retro, and I guess Preacher was the same.
Yeah.
Lost, everybody, you know, like if you can sort of remember Lost, that was kind of the same. It was sort of current, but with an old computer around.
That was an Apple, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't
Apple
branded,
II Plus.
But yeah. It looked like an Apple.
No, it was branded, I think, wasn't it? Wasn't it?
I don't recall seeing an Apple on it.
Yeah.
But I was watching when they would like type in the numbers to keep the place from blowing up.
Right. Well, the thing was, he had been like, yes, it was set more recently, but, you know, he'd been down there for some time. I think maybe when that room that it was in was constructed, that was a current machine, I think, was the thought.
Fair point.
I used to be a huge Lost fan.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. What else did I put? So Carrington, you mentioned devs. I didn't go back and look at that, but I guess there's a pet somewhere in there.
There totally is. Some dude who's normally funny, who's not funny in this.
Yeah.
It's a pet of some sort.
Okay.
Yep. That's a good show. I would recommend that show. That was good.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, I guess we talked about this last time, but it was after we stopped recording.
Oh,
so, but yes, it is good. I put Timeless down. I don't know if people have seen Timeless, but Timeless is sort of like a time travel show. But they don't tend to travel to places where there are old computers. However, they're in their sort of like bunker. There is like a shelf and some stuff around, and there's an old I think it's TRS-80 Model 3 or something, Model 4 or something sitting on the. Just sitting there. So I thought that was kind of cool.
How could you have a time machine and not travel back and go to like a Radio Shack or something?
Yeah.
Or Computer Worlds. Oh my God, what I do to go back to like 1983 and just go shopping. Yeah. I'm a minimalist and I would be just in heaven doing that.
It's not a bad show. But mostly they're going back to like, you know, further history, you know, Civil War and that kind of stuff. And then the IT Crowd was the last thing I had, I think, in this list. And so that one, that is set in basically the present, but it's a bunch of like computer tech guys in the basement of the company. And they've decorated the room with like all of the stuff that we collect, you know, so it's quite fun. I think this is Graham Linehan's show. And I think this was his sensibility that went into like decorating that office. Anyway, but that is also good. It's also, It has its ups and downs, but it's pretty good. I think that was about it for the shows and stuff. Anything else anyone wants to interject?
There's a book series if you like fantasy things. I wouldn't necessarily recommend. It's pretty good. It's this book called Magic 2.0. Do you guys know it? The Scott Meyer books, Off to Be the Wizard, etc. So it's I just thought of it because you were saying the time travel stuff. So first book is Off to Be the Wizard. It's a series of six fantasy novels about time travel and magicians, but the magicians are magicians because in their time they discover a file on a computer that's way bigger than the computer could possibly have a file on. So you'll hack into a network and then that file turns out to be the file of the universe. So you can find yourself in it and you can make a little change and suddenly you're 17 feet tall, or you can like put yourself a different place in space. It turns out we're in a computer simulation. Everybody who finds this file does something stupid to draw attention to themselves, and the police come calling because you give yourself yourself $1 billion to do something stupid. And almost everybody who finds this file figures, if I have to escape, where can I get away? And they pick this place in like medieval England where you could go back in time. And if you had access to this, you'd be like a wizard. And people just keep going back in time. And that's where all these wizards come from. So it's about wizards back in time using their computers from the period. So like one of the main characters has a Commodore 64. And so he's back in medieval England with a Commodore 64. And he uses that to pretend he's got magical abilities and stuff. So it's a comedy thing. It's weird, but it uses all vintage computers. And everybody kind of snarkily won't tell anybody else about their own future. So like if somebody comes back in time because they found the file in the 1960s and they've got their type of computer, people from the 1980s will mock them with their high-end Macs, but people from the 2030s will make fun of the Mac people and won't tell them like what happened later. So, well, you'll just have to wait till you get back there and find out, won't you? So it's kind of, it's a fun series because it's got lots of vintage computer stuff in it. So if you like that kind of...
What's it called?
The series is Magic 2.0. First book is Off to Be the Wizard by Scott Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R. So
are they
they're very fast reading.
Recently written or
yeah, very recent. Yeah, like it's a current series. I think the first book was probably 2013, 2014, something like that.
Nice. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems good.
Yeah. They're available. I just think they're also an audiobook for to listen to other people read to you. But they're really fast reads. They're like sit down in one evening and you're done kind of things.
Excellent.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. So as predicted, I suppose there's a ton of stuff and a ton of stuff we skipped too, I'm sure. But it's always kind of fun to kind of see
fun
old computers on your screens. And, you know, it is for those of us who have collected them. If Hollywood starts wanting them, here we are. Though, in fact, I mean, I know that if you're a museum and Hollywood wants to borrow your thing, you will probably think twice and charge a lot because Hollywood may not return it to you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Or they might return it to you, but painted orange because it fit the set. Hmm. So perhaps I can move on. I will move on to listener feedback. So let's see. I have a couple of things here. Quinn wrote on Twitter saying regarding the Quantel machine that we were wondering about, she believes the unit is a point-of-sale terminal, an electronic cash register, and not really a retro computer at all, and gives us a link that the company still exists. So I'm trying to remember this.
Was that two shows ago, I think? Because did I bring that up? I wasn't on the last show.
Yeah, I think it was two shows ago because in real-world time, the previous episode isn't out yet.
Sorry.
But soon. Yeah, no, I think this was the – this must have been like the 68 – machine that you'd never heard of.
Yeah, I think it had that was the thing, right? It had a 68,000, and that's why. But of course, point of sale, if it's, you know, that's maybe it's just a simple embedded situation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's less exciting than I'd hoped. Thanks, Quinn.
No, truly thanks, though.
Yeah.
But, let's see, and so Spectron, I don't know who the person is, but Spectron on Twitter linked us to a YouTube video of a Spectrum Next unboxing, which is kind of cool. Mm. So unboxing videos, there's probably not a whole lot of retro computing unboxing videos.
True.
This is sort of on the line, I suppose, of whether it's retro computing or not. It's a new computer, but it's a retro computer as well. Mm. But so if you wanted to see what comes in your Spectrum Next, you can head to YouTube and check that out. Bob wrote on email to tell us about some new Commodore 64 printed circuit boards. So I guess it's basically a repair part. And these are on Tindy and they come in different colors. So in the photo you can get, I see a black one and a blue one and a red one. And I think they're kits that so this is a kit that you would solder together, but this is the motherboard part. I don't know, is this something that people tend to need?
Oh, these. Yeah. So those are neat. Now, if you want to populate it, you're going to have all the parts to put in there. And it would be good, I think, for a couple of purposes. One is if the printed circuit board of your C64 has suffered some sort of extreme damage. The second thing is if you're just a modder who wants a cool colored printed circuit board and you want to build a Commodore 64 from scratch.
Cool.
And I think they're very reasonably priced, $35.
So, yeah. So if that's something of interest, that's kind of neat. If you have a broken C64.
So the other factor to think about there is that I'm not sure how many, but some number of chips within a Commodore 64 now have modern day replacements. Like you could use a CPLD or an FPGA or, you know, some circuitry or something like that to replace. And sometimes the replacements aren't 100%. Sometimes they are very close to or at 100%. But if you're building your own and you want to get as many modern parts as possible, and then for the parts that you can't source, new old stock or whatever, maybe those could come out of a broken machine or something like that. So you could have a reasonably new Commodore 64 with this.
And these are intended to go, you know, as direct replacements. I mean, like, they fit. So thanks, Bob. If people didn't know about that, now maybe they will. Oh, and John Mark wrote over email to correct us about the Alice. We said false things about the Alice. It is a little red. It's a little red computer. I think we said that it was a ZX Spectrum clone, but it is not. It's an MC10 clone. A machine that you wouldn't have thought someone would want to clone.
I would not have thought that.
But it's not even an entire clone, right? I didn't think the Alice was 100%, or is it? We're going to say more wrong things so that we can be corrected again.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's basically an MC10 clone, but I'm not sure if there are places of incompatibility. But it is runs on a 6803. It has 4K RAM unless you splurge and get the upgrade, which can get you to 20K.
That's too much RAM.
Yeah. But they look really cool.
It's physically shaped sort of like the MC10 as well, right? It's red, but isn't it physically shaped about the same? Like a little book.
The Alice has a nice shape to it. It's a red sort of like trapezoid. The MC10 looks like nothing in particular. It's just tiny. But yeah, I think the MC10 was not very good. But I mean, it was cheap. So
it was cheap, and it had a keyboard to remind you of that fact.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So another thing that we got was an email from Stephen, who pointed out that so we've talked a little bit about the Plato system, right? So basically lots of people would connect to it. It had sort of a graphical interface. It was used a lot in education. And there were also some games for it. And so there was a game called Camelot, and that is now working on the Cyber One Plato emulator. And there's actually a book, and this is the news part, that the guidebook was finished. And it is written by Josh Tabin, who actually was the one who wrote Camelot originally. So he's put together this 101-page guidebook to how you play the game, like what the history was, and various other things. So it's pretty cool. It's a role-playing game it's kind of wizardry-like, although you might say wizardry is kind of it-like.
It's kind of the opposite way around, right?
There's, and I don't think I've mentioned this before on an earlier show, but there's a book, we've talked about Plato in the past, and there's some Plato projects that are happening now. There's a book, one of the more recent, I guess it's the most recent tech book or computing history book I've read, called The Friendly Orange Glow. And it actually, describes it's by Brian Deere. It describes the creation of the Plato system, which, you know, had some revolutionary networking capabilities, and it's had an interesting take on a high resolution graphic display when there wasn't really any RAM, basically without using almost no RAM at all, utilizing a plasma persistent state display. But anyway, it was also notably one of the only landmark techs of this sort and magnitude that was developed in the Midwest. It had been typically East, you know, Silicon Valley or, you know, East Coast. And so I think there's the book goes into a lot of details about the significance of that part of the country and, you know, what was going on then. And there, a lot of people being unaware of the sorts of things that were happening there. So it's certainly a good read. I just wanted to mention that since we're talking about Plato.
I think we've mentioned the book at some point, but none of us had read it.
Okay.
So good to hear that it's good.
Yeah, it's available in audio book. Cool. I've read it. I own the hardback. I wanted to have it. It seemed like a notable book, and it was very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do know it's available on audio book.
Yeah, I think it may have been about then, around the publication of this book, that Plato really became something that I'd heard about. You know, like, I didn't know Plato. Plato was not part of my life before. But it is, you know, it's interesting that it existed and was, you know, part of a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, I'll add one more detail, is the fact I was aware of it in, like, 1983, but not for reasons that really, that I should have. There was the Plato teaching system was networked, and, you know, it involved, you know, multiple people being, you know, connected to this network, and it had, you know, networking was a big piece of it, but Texas Instruments contracted with whoever it is, the organization, you know, behind driving Plato, and they created a series of courseware cartridges that were educational, and they used the Plato learning system, but I think they didn't actually contain a Plato, because Plato involved a client terminal emulator sort of thing, and it didn't have any networking. It didn't involve a full, you know, Plato rendering, which actually does exist now on the TI as part of a recent effort, you know, with the current online Plato systems. But TI really advertised heavily. Like, they had a whole series of ads, and they had like 20 cartridges. And I remember I owned some of them because I was, you know, 11 or 12 when I had the TI. And so my parents were buying educational software, and I would do my best to prevent that from happening. But, but yeah, it was Plato, you know, but in the loosest terms. So that's, I oddly heard about it decades ago, but I didn't know what it was really until this book came out.
So this, I believe, is Control Data.
Yes,
that was behind
that. I think you're right.
And, I think I'd heard about those sort of standalone things myself too, but I didn't know until, you know, a couple of years ago that it was this big network thing as well.
Sure.
So there's a couple of, I have not fully wrapped my head around all of this stuff. Cyber One is one of the Plato hosts that you can connect to. And that's where this game is, this Camelot game is. We've talked a number of times about Errata Online, which is IRATA, which is another one, but it's not the same. So it doesn't connect to the Cyber One. You can use the same terminal, but it's kind of a different host. So,
Yeah. And notably, as we mentioned before, the Cherry Home behind the effort of Errata Online managed to basically write a client for every retro computing system that exists, which is sort of astounding. So like I said, the TI has a client, the Apple II, the Amiga. There's even a native client for the Mindset computer, which is something four people own one. I'm going to mention that computer in another segment coming up, but today. But
if anyway, we ever get there.
Yeah. So anyway.
Anyway, it's cool. I was going to try to, you know, try out this Camelot thing, but it turns out that in order to get a Cyber One account, you have to sort of submit a registration, and, you know, you might hear back in a week. and it's not on the Errata Online system. It's only on the Cyber One, I guess. So anyway, that was cool, though. I mean, not something I knew, and I think it's actually really quite nifty that the original author wrote up this book.
Yeah. Exactly. The fact that he did it is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Okay. I think I will leave the feedback there.
Okay. Can I do one real quick fact check?
Sure.
So the internet says that the Alice is a complete clone of the MC-10.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to listen to the
internet. Cancel your sending of emails.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think I was thinking about not the small MC-10, but I thought there was a Coco clone or something like that. I was getting that confused with it. It wasn't a 100% clone, but the Alice is. So
yeah, not Tano Dragon might be what you're
thinking
of.
Yes. Thank you.
British or UK.
So that was, I think, a not quite Coco clone.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's really testing our knowledge here. It's very good. Very good. All staying mentally alert.
What?
Okay. And speaking of mentally alert, Blake, you have the first thing.
Yeah, so sadly, just a little wanted to mention here, BBS is something I often talk about, and Bill Metcalf is a BBS game developer who passed away since the last show, I think on the 6th of May. He had, I mean, a lot of people, I'm sure not a huge amount of people were following his work, but he had a number of BBS games for the Atari 8-bit boards, you know, the, I guess utilizing the ATASCII, you know, emulation. But he worked with Tom McComb, and they wrote a number of BBS games, and they ran under the BBS Express Pro bulletin board system software. I had heard mention of him in, I hang out in an IRC, Atari IRC group, even though I'm not a huge, like, lifelong Atari guy. And I was,
you're a mole.
A mole. I mean, I like the, I've had some ST time in my past, and there's one on the desk, but yeah. But yeah, you know, it's always sad to see someone who has contributed to, you know, the notable pockets of things that we brought us joy in the past mm-hmm. online. He was 62, and he was the co-owner of Circular Logic. But anyway, I just wanted to, I thought that I'd mention that, having encountered that. And then the only other item that I have here today is I was leaving a comment on a video that was done by the iBook guy, who now goes by the name the 8-bit guy. I think that most of us know his YouTube channel. He was comparing the Macintosh to the Apple IIgs, and I was making a comment. And what, as I did, I noticed, I looked at some of the comments on the post, and it's not a new video. It's about it's a couple of years old, and the post I'm referring to is a year old, and it's Dan Oliver, and I'd seen his name before on, you know, some, I don't know if it was a screenshot from credits of a demo, or, you know, if it was just in some documents regarding Apple's history, but he was on the Apple IIgs team. I believe he was a fairly notable person on the team, and he talks about, he just goes into some detail over a few paragraphs about, you know, what the feeling was of the Apple II team at the time when the GS was you know, coming out, when it was going up against the Mac, and, you know, how Apple viewed the Mac. And these are two machines that could not really, like, the Apple II and the Macintosh weren't going to coexist for a great deal of time. And he shares some interesting insight on that. And there are some pieces that I hadn't been aware of. I think I'll let people read it. We'll provide the link, but it's interesting that at some point, as the team was deciding where the 2GS was going to go, even the Mac team seemed to, as he tells it, they were aware of the fact that they were, you know, trying to sell the current computers, but there wasn't for a while even a plan. Like, it didn't seem immediately obvious to Apple that, you know, they had to keep making bigger and better Macs. And so it's interesting to,
that it wouldn't be just like, that's the,
yeah,
Macintosh.
Here's the Macintosh, and yeah, now we'll figure something else out, you know. And of course, finally the Mac 2 and Mac SE came, but yeah, so it's interesting. It's just an interesting perspective, and in the responses he responds back himself, so it's an interesting read. We'll do a link to the specific comment, but I hadn't encountered it, and it seems interesting perspective.
I thought so too. I thought it was fascinating how he was saying how the Mac team was so insanely upset that they did a 6-color logo for the 2GS.
Right. Yeah.
In the UI.
Well, the 2GS, right? Because the GSO. Well, it wasn't, like, I don't think it was GSOS by name at first, but the first Finder that Apple called the Finder that was on the 2GS was, you know, of course it followed the Mac, but it was the first time that that desktop was presented in color, because the GS had color and it had its 640 by 200 resolution screen, and it was very easy for it to do a 6-color logo in the menu bar. And yeah, apparently that really, really upset the you know, it's not a particularly high resolution Apple if you compare it to the clean black and white of the Mac, but it's in color, and it's an interesting tidbit, but I guess I'm kind of not surprised when you think about that. But so certainly worth a read.
It is really cool when things like this will bring in, you know, players from the day, you know, like someone who was on the team or someone who wrote the software or whatever. That is really neat when these happen. And
very much.
It occurs to me that, you know, this is an archiving risk now, because even if you capture the video, those comments, I don't know if there's any way to archive those comments. So
yeah, it's interesting. I've seen blog posts. I mean, having run my own blog, Retrocomputer blog, since, you know, it's 2004. It's been quite a few years. Sometimes someone will happen in response to something I wrote, maybe in a week, maybe in 2 years, maybe in 8 years. And I try to, you know, something that's really gold like that, I'll try to, you know, kind of update the post and put it in the post. And I know that there's a better chance that, you know, as archive.org grabs it, it's going to be there. I don't know how comments will be prioritized. You know, are they always going to be, you know, as tightly held as the main content? But, you know, but you're right on something like the comments on YouTube or, you know, good Lord, Facebook, you know, that's just not what you're not. I'll cut and paste a huge swath of text. I've got this notes section where I just dump things that seem, you know, this is something I want to see 10 years from now, and I'm probably not going to be able to find it. But I'm not helping people out by having it in on my notepad, you know.
No.
I worry about these things.
Yeah, I definitely worry about that. A couple times ago, I talked about I had digitized some Apple videotapes or something at some point and put them up, and I got copyright strikes, and so I took them down. I don't think there were any comments on there, but that's the situation where you would lose treasured comments if, like, the video itself can't stay up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I think once it's struck, you know, the comments are gone too.
Yeah, and I would imagine that the search engines, not to, you know, belabor the, you know, hypothetically how these archive engines are going to handle comments, but especially when you have, like, you know, WordPress, here's the WordPress comment chunk, here's a blog, here's the discuss comment chunk. They are able to identify comments, and if they're going to make a call on what data am I going to save, I feel like comments maybe would be dropped. It seems like possibly the comments would be dropped because that's not core content. You know, potentially. So
yeah. Okay, we can move on to more Apple II stuff.
it's modern Macintosh stuff that it's connected to the Apple II. So Graphic Converter version 11. Graphic Converter has been around forever on the Mac, and I have, like most people, I've got the whole suite of all the Adobe software and blah blah blah. But Graphic Converter is one of those pieces of software that I've been using for a million years that I keep updated because it is the absolute Swiss Army knife of opening old graphics file formats. You can throw anything at it and it always seems to know how to open stuff and convert it. It is a great piece of software. When even Photoshop sometimes you get a JPEG, it'll say, Graphic Converter is like, yeah, I got you, fam. It just handles stuff. Graphic Converter 11, surprisingly, has now added Apple II single and double high-res import. So that's neat. It kind of came out of nowhere. So version 11 of the software can now open and convert Apple II software, Apple II graphics on your modern Mac. So that was neat.
Yep. That's pretty wild. And a graphic converter itself, I mean, like, I actually have not kept that up and I haven't used it, but that was the thing for a really long time for me.
Oh, yeah.
For me, it still is. It's still every once in a while because I do a lot of graphic stuff, and every once in a while, somebody will give me something, or I've got an old image from a backup, or I don't even know what this is. Who knows? And you can kind of drag anything onto Graphic Converter, and it'll figure it out. It's really, really good. Anyway, it does Apple II stuff, and I just was kind of surprised to see that in the notes. I'm like, oh, neat. Okay, yeah. So Apple II single and double high-res files can now be imported on a Mac using Graphic Converter 11.
I wonder what the sort of sparking event was for that. Like, somebody must have said.
I think he's running out of file formats. I think it's more just like what's left. Okay, let's start doing other computer sort of things. Who knows?
Yeah.
So, because it's been around for so long.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yep.
Earl, you have Atari news.
Yeah, this is fresh off the press. Actually, I like to look at Atari Age forums every now and then to see what's going on in the Atari 8-bit world. And this was just freshly posted from Rossum on the Atari Age forums, something called ATR Image Explorer. And it's a browser-based disassembler for various Atari-related files, like basic files, XEX, which is like it's a Atari executable. I think there may be metadata in the XEX files. I'm not exactly sure what all they contain, but They're Atari runnable files, ATR files, which are the disk images, and some other files. So this is just an HTML. It can run locally in your browser, like Chrome. It has an area that you can drag these files onto, and then it will show you the contents of the files. Like if you drag a disk image file onto it, it'll show you what's in the disk image. And then you can click on files within the disk image, and it will drill down further and show you what some of those contents are. And it can take executables and do like a real-time disassembly of them. It can show you text files. It was just really cool. I mean, I love this concept of these things that the browser and JavaScript and all that have become so powerful that you can run a little app just in your browser and it does useful stuff like this. And I also like the fact that I don't have to download some sort of executable per se and install it on Windows or install it on Mac or whatever. Mm-hmm. It just runs in the browser, which will also make it inherently cross-platform. So I thought it was cool. And people are already commenting in this particular thread on Atari Age with ideas. And the person who posted it solicited this and said, hey, here's what I got so far. If you've got some ideas on ways to make it better, let me know. And some people are already jumping in with some really good ideas. Like one person suggested to add in some of the special opcodes for the 6502C. And there were other good suggestions on there too. So anyway, fun stuff and just kind of a reminder in general that if you're into Atari 8-bits and some other Atari stuff too, Atari Age Forums is always a fun place to hang out.
Agreed. It's brutal.
Yeah, Atari Age actually has, they have a lot of stuff even beyond Atari, too. So,
very much.
It's a really, really yes. good forum. I noticed that this, you know, program, the Image Explorer, was updated 2 hours ago as we record.
Oh wow. So it came out about 12 or 14 hours ago, so that must mean that the author is already potentially responding to some of the feedback.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Very active development. It is. I mean, like, I understand that, like, on the Internet Archive, the emulators are all JavaScript and they're all running in your browser and stuff. But still, this somehow makes it comprehensible that it's like a web page that you drag an image onto and it does something.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
It's a .htm file.
Yep.
Very weird.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
All right. Jack, on to Macintosh.
Yeah, I have something. We talked before about this issue where old Macs can't update their date in the built-in control panels and things beyond 2020. And so there are fixes for that in forms of a utility you can run after launch time. But somebody had the idea to say, hey, what if we just go back and actually patch all these old system versions? So I found something called the Long View, which I've not seen before. They have a few different categories of things they're looking at. And this article in this section called The Long View is talking about this. Basically, they go through, they talk about why this is an issue, basically that Apple chose to represent dates back to halfway before the length of their thing. So this will be an issue again in a future date. But for now, what they decided to do is let's go through and fix all the utilities. So what they say here is, sequential operating systems, the programs that were used to set the time changed a lot. And they don't all work alike. We will fix them all. So basically diving through all these old versions of the Finder and how it would set the clock and just like detailing how they go through and they do a disassembly and find where the code is that makes this happen and just to sort of fix it everywhere. I don't see links in here to actually download the patched versions, but I presume it exists somewhere.
If you're interested enough, you'll type it out.
Yeah. And I haven't read all this, but it's pretty interesting. And I think I just like the gumption that somebody had to go through and say, you know what? I don't like their choice that they made back in the early 80s when they started doing this. Let's just go and fix all their old OSs. I like it.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
And then I think they should send copies to the people that worked on the original Mac versions. Yes. Like, I fixed your work.
Fixed it for you, buddy.
Fix that for you.
FTFY.
It looks like they're doing a fair amount of this stuff in
using ResEdit.
Yeah, yeah. Like Tmon.
Yeah, we have to go here. Just patching it.
Yeah. So
and Tmon.
That's cool. I mean, it's a little aggravating, I would imagine, to try to do the disassembly on the machine and so forth, but it's kind of cool. Yeah, I forget. I think the thing we talked about before was it was sort of an alternate control. Like the problem was that the control panel wouldn't set the date right, and this is like there was like an alternate application that could do it or something. Right. But this is a more comprehensive fix.
Right.
And it's aesthetically nicer to just have it be able to use the built-in things, yeah. Not have to run a third-party utility.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So they're saying that like the core thing is that. So the Mac never had a Y2K problem. It has 138 years and change of time that can represent, and that will expire in 2040. So 20 years from now, there's still a problem to be solved. But
always a problem to solve.
Yeah.
Two-digit dates are a problem. Four-digit dates are a problem.
It's after the Unix problem, the Unix time problem, which will
yeah, so really it won't be a problem because like nothing will be operational.
That's right.
Yeah.
So any problem past the EPOC power. Problem is not a problem.
Anyway, kind of fun article, I think.
Agreed.
Cool. All right, I have the next thing. I thought this was kind of neat. This has been passed around a little bit, but there's an article by Moritz and Alexander. Yeah, it was the article itself is actually from the end of October, so it's not super new. So it's called "Vintage Electronics for Trusted Radiation Measurements and Verified Dismantlement of Nuclear Weapons." And so the idea is basically that if you're going to check to make sure that someone is kind of like obeying treaties and that kind of thing with respect to nuclear weapons, you need to be able to test them, but everybody needs to be able to trust it. So you might have some kind of sort of state secret kind of stuff that you don't want information leaking out to the governing bodies about. I mean, like, so you're willing to submit to the checks for radiation or whatever, but you're not willing to give them your tech, right? And also the governing body wants to be able to tell, are you cheating somehow? And so the premise of this article is essentially that, modern computers are too complicated and, vintage computers are simple enough that we can trust them. They were not designed to leak information or smuggle anything out. So the proposal is basically, they kind of go through talking about a bunch of different things that have been used for information barriers. So the idea, information barrier being a thing that would sort of prevent you from stealing information from the people you're monitoring or whatever. And they sort of go through their ones that are based on 386, 486, ATmega chip, and FPGAs and things. And so they've designed one they're calling the IBX2. I forget what it stands for, but it's here somewhere. Even though it is the second in a series that's labeled IBX, I have to feel like the two might actually relate to the thing that they chose, because what they did was they chose to build it with an Apple IIe. So the 6502 is the machine that is going to do these measurements. The point is, and I don't know if I can make this big enough to see, but there's a very funny little photo of an Apple IIe setup.
That photo, yeah.
By a
that
warhead.
Photo made all the rounds. Yeah, it's hilarious. The IIe with a warhead.
Yeah. But I mean, essentially, it's got enough computing power to do the sampling, and it is simple enough. And it was not designed for this. So it's simple enough that. Everybody can trust it, that it doesn't have some sort of like secret backdoor or something like that. So this is actually a way in which vintage tech can be really used for modern purposes as vintage tech, which is kind of neat. So it's specifically the sort of powerlessness of it that it is.
Right. It's, all these backhanded compliments for the Apple
III. Yeah.
Luckily, it's so underpowered and so useless, we can trust it for this job.
I'd kind of look at it from the other perspective. And I think one of the things that draws a lot of us to the hobby is the simplicity of the systems means that you can wrap your brain around the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And
good point.
If you're wanting to make sure that somebody's not smuggling your state secrets out of your country and you want to be able to examine a system in total, then you need a simpler system. So,
I mean, your Apple II smuggling your secrets. Yeah,
exactly. But so they did some tests, with... I don't know what the Mirian Osprey is, but I guess this is a trusted testing platform against the IBX2, and they got basically the same kind of curve. So the measurements seem like they would work. So, Anyway, I thought it's an interesting idea. Kind of fits in a little bit with all the stuff that we've been talking about in the host topic as well. So that's it.
Cool.
Now, Carrington, you have the next thing.
We're going back to Bubbles. It's a video. Mm-hmm. Bubbles Whiting at the Center for Computing History has a 15-minute video that everybody should run to watch. It's amazing. All her videos are great, but this is a video of her telling you how to use punch cards, using a punch card machine, going through it. So she not only uses the punch card, she talks about the details, and talks about like specific memories of things. It's like a treasure trove of info and interesting things. It is like the best 15 minutes I've seen on YouTube in forever. It is so good. She's the delight. The tech is amazing. Even just looking in the background when she's doing stuff, you see all cool things. It's incredible. But just to see somebody who used punch cards back in the day using punch cards now and talking about it, it's great. It's like so, so fascinating. I could not look away for a second. I wish it was 3 hours, and it's 50 minutes of pure joy. Have any of you guys watched this thing?
No.
Not yet.
No.
But I will be.
Oh, yeah, you should.
Yeah, it is really cool. And she loved her Hollow Earth machine.
Right?
It is so funny.
The joy comes through. She's great. Oh my gosh. I just want to watch a TV show of her. She's so good. Anyway, strongly recommended. It's amazing. I saw this video. I was like, what?
Is she at a are they doing this at a computer museum? I'm looking at the desk in the background.
Yeah, Center for Computer.
Okay.
Yeah, Center for Computing History.
Okay.
Is where she is. And so that's my second mention of somebody named Bubbles.
Yeah.
It's all Bubbles all the time. I got a theme. Yeah, so strongly recommend. We'll have a link in the show notes. It's 15 minutes and it's great. Very quickly, I've got another video as well. A little less, no, not less interesting, just very different. It's somebody's got unbuilt, I think it's 11 different unbuilt kit computers from the 1970s, and goes through, and you can see the contents of the kits. Kind of opens them up, doesn't put anything together, but shows you what was in these unbuilt kits. And it's awesome. You get to see the like how they were packaged, what came with them. Most of them I never heard of, although there's an Altair among them, so there's some more famous ones, but a lot that I've never even heard of before. And it's really, really good. In a lot of cases, like here, he's showing, holding up magazine, because in addition to having the kit, he'll go to a magazine and show you an ad for that kit. So he said, like, this is the ad, here's what it sold for, here's the packaging it came in, here are all the parts and how they were bagged up. It's fascinating. So if you're interested in kit computers from the 70s, this is total joy. So another video I would strongly recommend. It's about half an hour long and very, very good. That's it. Two videos that are worth watching.
Excellent. And then for some reason I have an extra thing. So
excellent. Go Paul. More Paul. Old Paul. All done.
So this is really a fairly short thing, but you may recall that, you know, there was a time when people made a Pong on a chip, and, you know, so then suddenly you could make very simple Pong games.
Yes.
Sylvan, I guess this is Sylvan Lefebvre, has made Doom on a chip. So there's a write-up on Engadget about this chip plays Doom and nothing else. And
which is funny, because that's one of the things is everybody is like, can't run Doom. Can you run Doom? Doom on everything. Doom on every little thing that has any form of display. Yeah. Somebody writes Doom for it.
So there you go. So if you wanted to get a Doom on a chip, then you that is now possible. So
I do want to have Doom on a chip.
All right. I guess that's it. So now a word from our sponsor. We're back. So, in keeping with the commercial you just heard. The host restaurant computing gift idea. This was stuck in our list of possible ideas, and I thought this was kind of interesting, actually. This is an UpCart Plus for the Commodore 64. So what this is, it's a thing that you can buy from CoreI64.com. It is specific to the Commodore 64. So it is, you know, that's one maybe ding against it in terms of retro computing gift idea things, but it's kind of a neat idea, and maybe such things can come to exist or do for other computers. But basically, it's a little right-angle converter for cartridges in the Commodore 64 and 128, which would normally go in the back and then stick out. So what this does is make them stick up instead, so that it's sort of easier to, it's easier to fit the thing on your desk, I think, is mainly the idea. But I would imagine it's also kind of easier to put them, to sort of put them in and out as well. And so any cartridge computer, I could imagine, could conceivably use something like this.
It just seems more logical
to
have the cartridges go in vertically, like the old Atari 800 and 2600 and things like that. The only thing I'd worry about with something like this, or wonder about, I guess I would say, is when you pull the cartridge out, are you torquing the edge connector on the computer? You're probably going to want to put your hand on this.
Press down.
Press down as you pull the cartridge out so that you don't break the circuit card. But otherwise, this is really cool.
Maybe it has a lead bar at the bottom.
It seems like the case has little sort of ears off the side for that purpose. So you can push your thumb down onto that while you're lifting the cartridge out. Mm-hmm. So,
and they look pretty well made.
So two of the Atari systems had cartridge ports on the back side like this.
Uh-huh.
The 130XE and 65XE had that.
Okay.
And it is kind of annoying. Like it's much, much better to have it vertically.
Mm-hmm. So. The TI has a nice front loading cartridge, which is pleasant.
Yeah, I agree.
The stated purpose for this thing is that the sort of desks are shallower now. So, if you're going to put a cartridge in the back of your Commodore, it's going to bump up against all the wires of the wall or something like this. So,
actually, speaking of the TI, what they need to do is create a up angle so that when you have 7 feet of peripherals coming out the side of your TI-994A, you can actually have them stacked vertically going up towards the ceiling. And,
that would be very nice.
Yeah, that would, because desks are definitely not as wide as they used to be. TI people required a 14-foot
desk. But ceilings are just as high, so that's where the room is.
Yeah. Maybe you could make them on an arc so they go in a big circle around your TI-994A.
There you go, yeah. You'd need some shims like in between each one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
That would work.
So all kinds of product ideas we have here.
Excellent.
You can start with the UpCart Plus. It's been tested on some sort of known low tolerance cartridges. So I guess Turbo Chameleon version 1, for example. I'm not sure what makes it touchy, but it might well be, testing in something like the cartridge expanders or whatever, where, you can select from 4 different cartridges. I assume these are the ones that don't work so well in those.
It seems like a physical thing, right? Like maybe some cartridges had questionable construction, or the edge connectors were just a little finicky to begin with, and then you pop them in a expander or something like that, and they would tend not to work as well. I can't think of anything electrically that would, unless you were like really close tolerances on signal levels or something like that, it wouldn't make sense. Mm. But
it must be the case for Commodore cartridges that sometimes they'll have something other than just a ROM, right? I mean, like sometimes they'll have some actual processing inside.
Yeah, I think there's a 65816 20 megahertz accelerator called Super CPU. If I'm not mistaken, it plugs into the cartridge port, but maybe it's the user port. I thought it was the cartridge port.
That goes in the cartridge port, I think.
Okay.
They're unobtainium, so I've never even seen one in person.
Right,
but
right.
I think you're right. It goes in the cartridge port.
I could see that being a little testy.
Hmm. But there's a CPM card too, like a Z80.
That's right.
Cartridge as well, which presumably is something more than just a ROM.
Mm-hmm. No, it's got a Z80 in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a cool idea. It's kind of a weird gift idea, I suppose, but whatever. There you have it. They can't all be good.
They can't all be winners.
Okay. So when you're done with that, we can turn to eBay to continue spending money. And Blake, you have the first of our eBay auctions.
Okay, I've got two I'm going to talk about. The first one, it is so it's a ultra rare vintage Mindset computer system that boots, and in all caps, ultra rare, which is certainly warranted here. The Mindset computer was released in 1984 or so. It's an 80186 based. It's a graphics computer. It's technically a PC-ish clone. It runs MS-DOS or I think it's MS-DOS, but it's not very compatible. It's like a sort of like a Tandy 2000, which also is a 80186, in that it's not a, you can't really call it a full clone. But it does have quite the graphics capabilities for the time. It's similar to an Atari 520 ST as far as its graphics capabilities. It has 512 color palette, 320 by 216 colors, which, you know, is pretty meager for today, but that was dramatic. There was a world-class paint program for it called Lumina, and it actually has a position in the Museum of Modern Art as far as its industrial design. The base unit is there's a keyboard and a body that has two cartridge ports on the front. Another, I guess, like the PC Junior, a DOS machine with cartridge ports, and you can there's an expansion that was quite necessary that sat above it with two disk drives. At any rate, it's very much the unobtainium thing.
I was going to say, like, $2,000, well, it sounds like a lot of money for a buy it now. These are crazy rare. Yeah. I'm surprised this isn't a lot more money than that. Yeah. Like, I've never even seen one of these things. They sold for like a year or something.
Yeah, there's whenever you hear of someone that finds it, there are not many. I think someone was walking through one of these computer warehouse, you know, piles and piles of computers to be recycled, and he caught a glimpse of the corner of a machine and wrote someone in that town and got them to drive over and see if they could recover. I mean, he went to great lengths to get the hardware. And anyway, as you can see, here's the pictures I'm showing for the stream, or there's an interface, the main unit and the secondary unit, the label. But yeah, I've never seen one. There's a Mindset joystick that's part of this, and I've never even seen a picture of that.
Nope.
Which is
me neither. This really is one of the rare auctions where I think this person would have been much better off doing a starting bid and letting it go for something. Cause
yeah,
I think someone's going to snatch this up for $2,000 and be surprised at how cheap they got.
$2,000 is certainly a good price for this. I mean, even if someone could turn around and sell it for a lot more, but as an item to keep, it's quite a unit.
And the fact that it's working, like shown to be working and stuff like that, this is the biggest bargain I think we've seen on the show in a while. Like,
yeah,
I mean, I don't want one, but this is like the alternative universe Amiga, essentially.
Yeah,
like you just don't see these things.
Yeah, definitely. It's and there was some crossover. The engineers on this, I think, actually migrated to Atari to help with the 520 ST. I've written about it a few times in the past. I don't recall the details, but yeah, it's definitely a keeper.
Yeah.
So some lucky collector will get this one, but
I think nobody has I think the only reason it's on eBay and hasn't sold is who the heck would have this on a watch list? So it's like, oh, I didn't think that would come up.
It doesn't look funny. Yellow. It doesn't look particularly yellowed either. I mean, it looks like it's in really good physical condition.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned earlier, Thomas Cherryholme made a native Plato client for this specific machine that utilizes its graphics capabilities, which I don't even know what to say about that. But so this is about the best, one of the better deals I've seen. It looks like, it's going for, buy it now, $1,999, $100 shipping from outside the U.S. I guess it's coming from Nova Scotia. Maybe you could walk over there, Carrington.
Just walk over the coast and get right on that.
This is that same seller we've seen a number of things from, Sci-Fi Man. This,
normally Sci-Fi Man kind of doesn't underprice things, so I'm surprised. Yeah. Anyway, I would have guessed that this would go high, and I usually think things are not worth what other people think they're worth. Mm. So I'm still surprised.
Especially since every time I search eBay for the show, or you know, I do it occasionally in between, you know, I always look for the highest price to see what the funniest is. And I think right now there's like a a NVIDIA GeForce 2 graphics card for $6,000. So given that that's out there, I mean, this makes this even better a buy. But anyway, so that's a very nice unit. Yep. And the only other piece that I want to get through here is it's an Exatron stringy floppy disk drive wafer, lot of 40. And I think we've talked about the Exatron drives. I know for a while, a cheaper, medium between floppy disks and cassette tapes was the stringy floppy, which is a fancy perpetually looping cassette tape that can, access automatically. It's linear access, but also sort of random. Anyway, here's a lot of 40. It doesn't really say if they're... It says pulled from a working environment, but some have scuffs. I guess they're not necessarily, new. But I don't recall ever having seen any significant amount of these offered up. And actually, it would be interesting to see what the data on these things is. I wonder. But I know there are drives for. I think there's an Exatron for the TRS-80 line, and I think there are a few British computers that used it. Do you recall any other specific uses of this? Anyone?
No. I think this is the thing that made me get a Spectrum, right? I think that was what, because I got a drive and then I had to get the computer that it would plug into.
Okay, yeah. And the some of the Spectrums, I know like the QL had a wafer drive, but I don't believe that was the Exatron. I think that was a different proprietary. But I believe there was one of these for the Spectrum. But anyway, so if you need some wafers for your wafer tape drive, I think the Compact Computer 40 TI's Hexbus thing had a wafer tape drive that might have used these. $299, a lot of 40 from Seattle, Washington, and I would need to do some calculation, apparently, to find out how much the shipping is. But I'm not going to order them, so I'm not going to do that. But I just wanted to pass that on, and that's all I've got from eBay today.
I think that's interesting. I don't feel like I've seen the media before. I mean, like, this is very clearly, like, you can see what's happening with the tape in this. I thought they were opaque.
Yeah, I just zoomed in. You can sort of see, I've never seen clear ones, so you can see how the tape flips from, being vertical to horizontal, and then it spools back in to the center reel. Interesting tech. So it seems like this, the wafers to me seem like it would have some wear to it. It seems like, the tape's going through these gyrations. It would make me a little nervous to... this doesn't seem like a real backup solution, so to speak. But but again, I think they were. But this is back when floppy disks were prohibitively expensive, and everyone was using cassette tapes, and this was the medium. So it fit a niche, I guess. That was.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think these were the thing that were, it was sort of halfway between.
Yeah, nobody wanted to be using these instead of floppies. Everybody would rather have a floppy disk drive, but these were a lot better than lining up the tape counter and hitting play on your, on your Sony tape player or whatever.
I just can't believe these things don't get eaten.
Does anybody know how much data was stored per each of these things?
I see a couple of the tapes said 16K, and I'm not sure if that is the absolute limit.
Although that may have been talking about how much memory the computer had to have in order to run the program that was on it.
Okay. Yeah. Now I'm actually now looking, it's just Wikipedia, but it says Radio Shack, they're mentioning their drives. Radio Shack actually might have sold a drive. At least several people made them for the Radio Shack Model 1. VIC-20, Commodore 64, TI CC-40. Yep, I guess that was the one that the TI-99-8 and the CC-40 were going to use, but they don't. It says the cart wafers were available with lengths ranging from 5 to 75 feet. Capacities are 4K for 5 feet, 16K for 20 feet, 48K for 50 feet, and 64K for 75 feet. One complete cycle to the 20-foot loop took 55 seconds.
Yeah.
To read some Wikipedia to you.
It's funny, though. You look at these and you just wonder, was this a good idea?
Right.
No, it was not.
Because... it seems so easy for it to fail. But
I feel like I can see it losing data just looking at it. You're like,
yeah.
There's a little kink. There's a bit missing.
Right. And yeah. then, but it's going at high velocity. So as soon as that kink, you know, hits a dead spot, then suddenly the whole thing is unspooled.
You could hear it.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah. That'd
be fun, I guess. And suddenly it shoots across the room.
Or it locks up the little thing and then the engine starts smoking and
yeah.
Excellent.
Something catches on fire and then falls off the table and sets the curtain on fire.
It's a testament to how bad it was using standard cassette decks for data storage, I guess, to endure that. But anyway, that's what I got.
All right.
Cool.
Carrington, you have the next ones. A
few links, but really just three choices. I'm sharing my screen here. First one is a t-shirt. Mm-hmm. It's a $90 t-shirt. It is the AOL Running Man. So if you want an AOL shirt, like super early on, it's still sealed. And what I liked about it was the way it came packaged, kind of sealed and shrink wrapped into the shape of that little AOL Running dude. It's from the collection of somebody who was a very early AOL employee. Because it was like a gift to them, there's no label on it that you can see without opening up. So the person doesn't know what size it is, but he says it was a relatively bigger guy. So it's probably larger and extra large. But who knows? You buys your auction, you takes your chances. But if you're a collector of obscure AOL memorabilia and you want to branch out from floppies and CDs, then there's an option to buy a sealed Running Man shirt.
Yeah, that would be so rough, though, to buy this and open it. I mean, like, because you can't
open it. You just have to have it, I think, and use it as a pillow or something.
Because you would never get it back in that plastic.
Never. It is hardcore shrink-wrapped into this weird shape. So that was the first one. It caught my eye because, like, it's a weird shape for a t-shirt to come in. But it's also $90, so you got to be a real AOL fan for that. Second choice is a person has a number of stickers, and these kind of caught my eye because I like how creative they are. One of them is my other computer is an Apple II, and they have a Commodore 64 version of this. So you can say my other computer is a Commodore 64. There's my other tablet is a Newton. It's got a bunch of WAS inside stickers. So instead of Intel inside, WAS inside. So I like the creativity of these. So this Retro Geek collection person, and I really dig the my other computer is an Apple II. I would put that on a laptop. And they're not super pricey, you know, 240 in euros. So that's like about 250 US or something. So not bad for a sticker. You get just one of them, but how many stickers do you really need? Paul, how many stickers do you
put,
need?
Yeah, you put them on all of your Commodores, right?
But on your Commodore, you put them on, say, like the Apple II, and on the Apple II, you put my other ones a Commodore, and it's all legitimate. I just like the stickers. They're a little more creative than the normal ones you see. So if you sticker up your computers, this is probably a person who's got a bunch that you'd want. I like the tablet one in particular. My other tablet's a Newton. I could put that on. I could see me putting that on my iPad. So I dug it. And last choice is something I don't recommend, but something I had. So it's one of those auctions that just is immediately evocative of a thing I had and disliked. It was my very first printer ever, and it turns out that was the Radio Shack CGP 115. I didn't know what it was called. I just knew it was a tiny little thing. It takes these four little tiny color pens. So you get a little mini blue pen and red pen and green pen and presumably black, I guess, is the other color. And it's a plotter, but the paper that comes out of it is the size of a cash register tape. It is the most useless printer you can imagine. But this was my first printer. So my gosh. And weirdly, I'll have a link in the auction as well. I've got this, and then it says the only thing missing from it, because it's a boxed, beautifully working copy of this terrible printer, but it says it's missing one of the reels of paper. But another person is currently selling a collection of four rolls of paper for this printer. So it's time for Paul to buy this printer, is what I'm saying. Everything has come together. It's time for Paul to purchase a printer.
Yeah.
It's a terrible printer.
I had the Atari version of this same thing. I think the Atari one was called the 1020 plotter. Also the four pen thing, the narrow paper.
Was it terrible?
Yeah, it was terrible, but it was also wonderful. It was great. It was like,
it was my first printer. Like, it's the first thing I ever had that could print. So
me too. My first
printer. I have a soft spot because of that.
It was cheap compared to a real printer.
I think that's why it was my first printer.
And it could do some color, and you could like, you could send it commands from BASIC to draw lines and stuff like that. You could sort of like, it had sort of a weird kind of protocol you could tell it to do stuff. It was fun to play with.
But you can see from the picture on the box, it shows this graph.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, look at this, profits. And it shows the three colors. We're printing it out, and it's got a red bar and a green bar and a blue bar. And with black, because those are the three colors. You can't mix them. You got three colors that you can draw in. But what you can't tell from really looking at this is, like, the span of your hand is much wider than the printer.
Right.
Like, it's like these things are, or at least wider than the paper.
Right.
They're hilariously useless and slow as the little pen draws on it. But I printed many a cocoa listing from this thing. So,
oh yeah,
those are my choices.
See, this is, for plotters, it would be kind of useful to have like a cursive font.
Oh sure.
Where so just like the pen just stays down.
I don't think I ever printed a graph. I think I just printed small listings. I bet you I never even ran out of ink on the first pens. Like I was happy to have it because it was a printer. I never had a printer, but this was a gift, and I learned later to think, well, that's a useless printer when I got later printers. So those are my choices.
Excellent.
My other printer is more capable. We'll make a sticker. Yeah. My other printer is full size.
My other printer is a 4-pen plotter.
Yes. okay, Earl, you have some deck stuff.
I do. So the first one that I have here, I found particularly interesting because, first off, it's inexpensive. Secondly, it looks like it is an artifact from back in the day. It's a deck paper tape, and I think it has a PDP-8 program on it. And the cool part about that is that it would fill a niche in my collection because I have a variety of other kinds of like personal storage, you know, like a 8-inch floppy, 5 1/4-inch, a couple of reel-to-reel tape, like the 6250 tape reels. But I don't have any paper tape. I have punch cards and that kind of thing. So this seemed like an inexpensive artifact. Now, I was curious, though, thinking, well, I wouldn't want to buy it and take it from somebody who is actually going to use it. But, I mean, what are the chances that somebody with a PDP-8 is going to want to take this folded paper tape? This was the one thing that they needed to make their PDP-8 work, and I took it from them just to stick it away in a drawer somewhere. But I thought it was really cool. It has the deck logo on it. You know, it was interesting, like, hey, kids, this is what we did when we walked 5 miles uphill in the snow. We had paper tape. And so anyway, I thought it was a cool auction. It looked like it was in good shape, too. And for $10, how could you go wrong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So I assume when you feed this in, I don't actually know how paper tapes work, but it looks like there's a track that it feeds on.
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me, too.
But you must have to put the label past that because the label has no holes in it.
Yeah, I actually don't know either. And I mean, I used these back in the day, I'm sorry to say, but I don't know how they work.
I wonder how many of these that were well used actually have holes punched all the way through the label as the machine ran through it. People are like, ah, screw it. I don't got to keep this nice.
That's true. Although you would want to keep that header information so that you would know what this paper tape was for.
What the heck? Yeah, because it does look like the name for the program lines up pretty nicely with the that guy tried to punch right through it. Too bad. Could have been anything.
Have you seen my debug program? No.
Don't know.
Maybe. Is it called hole, 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 hole?
So that was one. So the other, I just looked at and I thought, why is this a thing? So this is an eBay auction for a Commodore shot glass. I couldn't tell based on the auction whether this was something that was new, like newly created, or if this was a shot glass from back in the day. It looks like it's in really good shape. It's got the Commodore chicken head logo, gold rim on the top, shot glass size. And if unless somebody's bought them, at the time that I was looking, there were four available. It was $10 with, you know, like cheap shipping or something like that, or maybe free. So I was looking at this, I was thinking, okay, the description said something on the order of, you know, a nice addition to any collection. And I thought, I'm a Commodore guy, and I just don't think I need this. I was trying to imagine the scenario in which I would break this out. You know, it's like you take your finest stuff off the top shelf, and you go, what am I going to drink this with? Wait, I know. It's my Commodore shot glass. I said, what do you guys think of this? I mean, irrespective of the whole Commodore thing.
I actually, the last time that I went to the retro gathering here in Sweden, there was a seller who was selling small glasses that they had somehow, they must have had some equipment. They have some etching equipment, and they had etched in. So I actually bought two shot glasses and two small whiskey tumblers with Atari logos on them. But they had all kinds of logos on them.
Were they new?
You're right. I have never used them.
Or were they from back in the day?
These were new. These were definitely new.
I'm thinking maybe this is new too. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
I think this is new because the seller is like a printer.
Oh, good catch.
Yep. There you go.
Because Action Quick Print. And also the seller has a Next computer shot glass logo one as well.
Interesting.
So I stuck that in the link. Okay. So I think it's just like a retro computer fan who has a printer and is a drinker. I can combine my hobbies.
He has a three-color plotter.
Yeah.
Put those pens to good
use.
So
you haven't busted those out, Jack? Like if you're having a guest over, you know, what are we going to suck down some of this awesome whiskey with?
Well, you know, I think I bought them last September or something. I feel like half of that time we've been in quarantine. I haven't had a lot of guests.
Oh.
Yeah, but you think there would have been a lot of drinking there.
Yeah, you don't need guests to do a little drinking.
That's true.
To drink in quarantine. Are you kidding me?
I thought maybe it was an artifact from the deep days, the last days of Commodore. Maybe it belonged to Irving Gould, and when he was deciding how much money to inject into Commodore before they went bankrupt, he'd take a shot or two.
Yeah, or was he and Trammell on the pet jet? You know, they're cruising along.
Yeah. But I guess, sadly, it's a printer. Oh, nice.
These things that I bought are, the shot glasses are this kind of smaller variety.
Those are nice looking, actually.
Oh, that's a double.
So these are narrow and tall, and then I got these little whiskey tumblers also, and they had a bunch of different ones. They had like,
that's classy.
Yeah, they're pretty nice, and I think
I like it.
The glasses themselves, the big one is marked IKEA on the bottom, so they're
small ones. Oh, Swedish. I think they just took glasses and etched them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just like bought glasses from wherever and etched them.
Yeah.
And they had a ton of different ones.
Etching's really easy if you guys haven't done it, because there's etching stuff. You basically have a template. You put it on. You rub on the etching cream. You wait a bit. You rinse it off. You've etched glass. It's really simple.
Oh, wow.
Cool.
Yeah, so you can actually etch into most glass really easily.
Right. And these were quite inexpensive. I think they cost like $3 and $6 or something like that.
Hey, where'd Blake go? There he is.
He's off to do some etching.
Oh.
I'm going to show you my
Blake has a Goonies mug.
Nice. A Goonies mug from the 80s. I can't find any of my shot glasses, but they're probably rolling around the floor.
So a full 8-ounce Goonies tumbler becomes your quarantine shot glass.
This is like a triple shot, I guess, maybe. I don't know. Maybe something like that. But anyway.
Very nice.
Nice. Okay, Paul, I think we're on to you. What have you got for us to purchase?
Okay, yeah.
What do you got that can compare to a Goonies tumbler?
I'm not sure that I can beat that, but let's see.
Nothing can beat that.
Well, what do I want to talk about? I have many, many options. But okay, so the first one is a Prometheus Products Apple Assurance Diagnostic Disk Controller for your Apple II. And what it is, this box also contains a regular disk controller, but the Prometheus one is the one that's in the bag here. And Prometheus is a fairly big maker of cards. What this turns out to be, I'd never heard of this before, you know, today.
Yeah, what is Apple Assurance?
It's basically a power-on self-test for your Apple II. So it'll check some of your ROMs. It'll test your RAM if you want. And you stick it in place of your disk controller card. So anytime you would have booted from your disk controller card, it will instead put up a diagnostic menu for a second.
So it checks everything about your computer except the disk drives.
I don't know exactly what the... Well, let's see.
Because
so,
you're replacing this.
Is it a disk controller card itself?
It is, yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool.
So I found a presentation by Stephen Buggy, and I think I forget when the presentation was, it says 1996. Stephen Buggy presented this at Kansas Fest, but there's a couple of things you can check with it, and it'll tell you the checksum of the ROM, and then you can sort of see if that matches what you think it should be. So my impression of this was that, like, it's sort of a good idea to have a par on self-test of a sort.
Have a post on it.
But this, it's not actually that. It's a boot self-test. And it doesn't do very much. So,
because it's after boot, after you go in, then it says, okay, now let me see. Yeah, your ROM is your ROM.
Yeah, well, it's after power on, but pre-boot, and it happens every time you boot. And if you want to skip past it, then you can hit something.
Oh, of course, it's going to be before. Yeah.
But so I liked this quote from Stephen Buggy's presentation. It says, little is done, but what is done is frequently seen. So, and that I think was basically the
I don't do much, but I do it all the time.
The complaint about this. There are a couple different reviews of it, but everybody kind of panned it. You know, it's sort of like it does too little, too often, too clunkily.
It was $70.
Yeah.
It looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. Jameco Electronics sold it. Huh. But anyway, so it's a unusual card because it's unpleasant to use. But there you go. Anyway, I'd never seen it before. It's not going for very much to watch list. Okay. What else? This is also just sort of like a simple thing. Someone is selling. Is it the same person? Might be. No. Yeah, it's the same person. I guess I liked this person's stuff. This is a bunch of old personal software Visi stuff. So VisiDex, VisiFile, VisiCalc, and the CCA data management system.
I love their padded cover binders.
Yeah.
Those are so cool.
Little binders,
I remember those
yeah.
from back in the day.
Nothing says like real business software to me, like a padded yeah. binder.
Yeah, these are nice. And they're old, too. I mean, like, so this is like the first run of these things. So these are pretty collectible, actually. You can see the date on the VisiCalc disk is December 5th, 1979. So that's really old. I forget when it came out, but it's like August 1979 or something. I mean, like, this is one of the early
ones. I was going to say, it's 79 anyway. Yeah. And I don't think early 79. So, yeah, so that is a really early version of this. As someone who leapt right on it said,
I
envision good things for this.
Yeah, and it's starting at a $50 starting bid, so it's not bad. I'm seeing a bunch of things here which I try it harder than that to collect, and now, you know, mm-hmm. here they are. But, do I want to keep talking about these things? I don't know. I'm just paging through tabs now. I only wanted to comment about the Tandy 1000EX. Is this a common computer? Do people know this computer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It looks really terrible.
See, it's not you just shave it.
Basically. Well, when I looked at it, I mean, it reminded me of the Pravets, which is this Bulgarian computer. It has that same kind of like, just, I don't know, it's very sort of utilitarian.
Well, it was just a pretty generic IBM clone.
Floppy drive on the side.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I actually Craigslisted last holiday, a year ago, year and a half ago, the 1000HX and built it up. It's this machine, but with two 3.5-inch drives on the front.
I see.
Yeah. It's a nice little – it was very, very popular. It was a huge Tandy seller.
Interesting.
Yeah, more powerful than the 1000. I think it has 8 megahertz instead of 4.77 8088 2. So it's a little faster, you know, cheaper.
It's really embracing that typewriter form factor, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I think they took those, the plus cards or whatever, to upgrade them, if I remember.
The plus cards. Yeah. They're electronically identical to ISA, but. It actually
it was like a pin connector thing.
Yeah. For the HX, I ended up buying some. You can get plus two ISA adapters, and so I mounted some, like a serial card and a CF IDE controller, two ISA cards that are DAPT. So you can do that if you. The unobtainium thing though is the Tandy 640K memory expansion. You'll see people buy them. As I did, I bought an EX just to get the 640K memory expansor plus card because it has the risers that provide the additional two plus things. You have to have that if you want to fully expand. So it's there's a whole situation with these with these form factor Tandys. They're well desired.
Interesting. Yeah. Today. I really feel like I have not come across them much at all in my various eBay excursions.
One of the neat things about them, I don't think all of the like the 1000s that do that. Like, I don't remember which models did this, but at some point they started doing the drive swapping thing. So you've got the A and the B drives, but on boot you can say, no, I want B to be A and A to be B instead. And so you could boot from either one. And so it made it like, I don't know why that was useful, but it was like one of the big selling points is you have two different ways to boot and you can easily swap between them. I don't know why it suddenly became a big deal that A was B and B was A, but it was like one of the differentiating features that they thought was a big deal.
If you're curious, I have a picture of two pictures of mine include, that shows the inside of the Plus adapter. The HX version has space for two front mounted drives, and I think the CPU is the same. I know this was an 8882. I think that's the same with the EX. This came right after the EX, and this I think this one has DOS in ROM. It's pointless, nothing but DOS boot. There's no commands, so it's almost pointless. But it has that in ROM, and then you can see here inside of it are some Plus adapter. There's a ribbon cable adapter, and that's an IDE controller. Right. And there's the Unobtainium 640K Tandy memory card that has a DMA controller, and then it has two risers for the Plus. So here you can have memory. Basically, if you plug this in, you get memory plus two more quote-unquote ISA Plus slots, and then you can expand fully. So that's about.
Cool. Okay, let's see. I have two more things that I will mention. One is, it's just a big lot. This is something Ian actually pointed out to me, but entire lot of vintage Steck PDP 11 and others books. And so if this is the kind of thing that you find interesting, there's a ton of stuff here. Basically Deck stuff. I see there's like a VT100 manual user guide here. There's some marketing things.
There's a lot of books. This would be a heavy shipment. Yeah.
This is sort of outside my area enough that I just can't imagine finding a place for these things. But I also have this kind of feeling that the Deck community has documented a fair amount of these things. But I don't know. I wonder about those, like the marketing materials. And I know with those, you know, the orange manuals and things, there were updates, right? And so the Apple repair manuals are like this too. Like, having the set does not mean you have them. You have them at a moment in time.
Right.
So I don't know.
Well, in one of the books in here, the one toward the bottom there, the gray book, I'd had a little bit of trouble finding online. I think I finally did find it online, but I actually have that in hard copy, and it had some very useful reference material in there for the PDP 11 stuff that I've got. And so it's possible that there's other books that we're looking at here that aren't online either. It's tough to tell.
Yeah. And I mean, you can tell basically that this person is about ready to just be rid of the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway, if that is something you're interested in, it's not super expensive really for what it is. I mean, like right now it's at a $53 bid, and at least shipping to me from the other side of the continent, it's like under $50. And then this is the last thing. I thought it was just sort of interesting, I guess. More Apple II peripherals, but this is an external Apple II keyboard.
I've seen this looks familiar to me.
Does it?
Yeah, that's a Coleco Atom keyboard.
Yeah, exactly. I was wondering about that.
Oh, that's where I recognize that. Okay, cool. I kept thinking I gotta know that side part.
Hmm. I mean, and if you look at it, it's got like stickers on some of the keys.
Yeah, but not as an Apple II thing.
So I think it may well be actually a Coleco Atom keyboard.
I was going to say, like, I don't recognize this as an Apple II thing, but the right side of it all seemed really weirdly familiar to me. That's why. I think this is an Apple keyboard. And so was this a thing, like at the time, somebody took this keyboard? Yeah, this is a vintage thing. Yeah. Like this was sold at the time. That
is the real thing here that is there an adapter? Is that what we're really talking about? I mean, is it that someone said, oh, here's an adapter, and that would be it to use an Atom keyboard? I wonder if that's the thing that was sold, you know?
Yeah, I think that may well be the value add, at least.
Yeah.
There's a photo here that sort of shows it in use, in a sort of like old tech photocopied manual.
Yeah.
And it seems to show that interface card just sort of like sitting on the carpet next to next to, you know, like on the desk, just out in the open.
Yeah.
So this is like 1989-1990 time frame. So Martech Electronics has made available this IBM-style keyboard for the Apple II Plus and IIe. Somewhere else, I think it was suggested that this is basically just like a one-person operation. So it's quite possible that there's just, you know, they get an order, they go out and buy an Atom.
Yeah, well, I mean, at this point, there was probably a pile of Atoms, you know, people, resellers, you know, like some kind of, I'm sure it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that it was actually the case that Atom Basic was compatible with AppleSoft Basic, interestingly. It's same commands, same everything.
Oh, interesting.
It's interesting that they, part of the pitch for this, reading the little manual comes with it, is that you get the 12 function keys that are programmable. So you can load up and save in them commands for like catalog or PR number 6, whatever, and just execute them with one keystroke. And that this works for the 2 Plus. So you get with, if you add it to a 2 Plus, you're getting auto repeat and Apple, the Apple keys and caps lock and proper full arrow keys and all that. So I can see it as being a real upgrade for an early Apple.
It's so weird.
It's neat. I mean, it's ugly, but it's neat.
The color is kind of nice in so far as it looks like certain kinds of corn, right?
The problem is the inconsistency of the
where everything kind of like slightly different yellow.
Different keys were planted in different seasons, apparently.
Yeah.
Because some are a deep golden and some are not. And that is just messing with my eyes.
It's not super expensive either. It's $50. Anyway. Okay. So that's it for me. I don't know how long we've been recording, but it's really getting absurd now. So let's move to closing discussions.
Sounds good.
I agree.
So I guess, Blake, you are the first.
All right. Well, I'll mention that I need a haircut, and I'm looking forward to getting one. I think I said that earlier. The other thing, more relevant to the show, is I recently picked up a HP 1100LX. It's a clamshell, little handheld clamshell. It's DOS compatible, standard CGA DOS. It runs at 80186 at some speed, I think 7 megahertz or something. You load, you can put a flash card in the side, or it has a serial port that's extremely non-standard, so good luck finding a cable. It has infrared, if you happen to have some kind of device that can communicate that way with it. But so I thought I'd play with it. I found it for a reasonable price on eBay, and I, over the years, I've dabbled here and there with handhelds, and I was inspired to play with this one, so we'll see how that goes. But
cool.
That's about it for me.
Cool.
Yep, I'm unfamiliar with that one.
No, me neither. Or me too, yes. Me too is not familiar.
Yeah, this is what happens when we get close to the 3-hour mark.
and as for me, as for news, I don't need a haircut.
All right.
And I don't have a HP clamshell. I am the anti-Blake.
It's like anti-M, right?
Exactly. Anti-Blake, anti-Blake.
Earl, what news from Portland?
Well, I bought an upgrade like I do every few years to the Amiga Forever package. It's kind of an interesting combination of an emulator, some officially licensed ROMs that they'd somehow licensed through the whole, you know, this kind of weird chain of IP that happened with Commodore stuff. But it also has a nice launcher. It bundles with some games and demos and has a Windows installer, so you run it and you can double click on what you want to run and boom, up comes an Amiga and you can do fun stuff with it. And I've always liked it. I like to support them. And they had a really good offer recently for an upgrade for people who were already customers. So I bought it, I ran it, having fun with it. Fun to see some of the old Amiga demos, and I also want to learn a little bit about Amiga programming because I know less than zero about how to program an Amiga. And I think I'd like to know how you do that stuff. And the other thing, I just don't understand this. So my daughter is a marketing major. We were looking over my YouTube channel to see how you could improve it. Sorry, it's basically like, well, anything. Do anything and you will improve it. But we looked at one of the videos that I put up of an unboxing of Clipper version, some are 87. Clipper was a DBase compiler, and mm-hmm. I loved it back in the day. It was great. It was efficient. It made me lots of money. So I figured, you know, a handful of people will watch it, and that's what happened. When I put it up, I had like 20, 30 views, and I thought, great. So she's looking at the video. She's like, do you know you have 1,600 views on this thing? I'm like, that, there's,
why is
there's
everybody
no
love Clipper?
Way, no way 1,600 people wanted to click on that and watch me take Clipper Summer 87 out of a shrink wrap box. So this is a mystery to me. So peoples of the internet, tell me, why are you watching this video? Is it
DBase compiling is making a big comeback in 2020?
Apparently. Yeah, along with COBOL, you know, that's the stuff. So I don't get it, but thank you very much for watching.
Hmm. Very weird.
Sweet.
Jack, what of interest with you?
I don't have anything except I was all geared up that I was going to upgrade my Atari 600XL to a full 64K of RAM this weekend, and I didn't do it.
You were geared?
I just didn't do it. That's it.
Oh, I see. Oh. I was expecting a bigger bang to that story.
No, no, just kind of a letdown. I just didn't do it. I was like, I'm going to do it, and then I didn't do it.
I'm going to do it.
That's my news.
Nice. Well, if that's what we're going to talk about here, then I got a million of those.
I can talk about stuff I didn't do. I got tons of stuff I didn't do this weekend.
Yeah, I have a ton of things I didn't do also, but that's the only thing retro computing related that I didn't do.
Okay,
but meant to
fair
do.
Enough.
So you almost did.
Almost.
Cool. And what about you, Paul? What
all
you
right.
Got? Oh, you got postcards.
I did. Yeah. I mean, we talked about this a while ago, but exciting. I don't know if they're visible, but.
So they showed up? That's cool.
Yeah. The Royal Mail sent.
I didn't pull the trigger on those. Yeah. I was seriously tempted.
So, anyway, yeah, I haven't opened them any further. So all I know is the Elite's on the front. But
right.
And I don't have anyone to send them to, but whatever. So that was kind of cool. And also the 100, whatever it was, the 100 iconic home computers that defined a digital generation or whatever, that book, that came. It's super thick. And I also noticed that even CNN had a piece about it. Like before we had linked to the Guardian that was talking about this new book, but made it onto CNN too, which is on this side of the ocean. So
cool.
Otherwise, you know, I'm still here in my apartment.
As are we all. Well, we're not all in your apartment. But
that's true. That's true. at least not.
As far as you know, Paul.
So, yeah, that's about it. I don't know. I will close this out if that is good. Is that good?
That works.
Yep.
Right. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast or send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com, and please write a review on iTunes. In principle, it might help marketing. I don't know. You can, Earl can fill us in on that. But, and until next time,
Retro Compute!